of the different committees. Also welcome FFC and PBO, members of the media, public, our support staff, and everybody's on the platform. Good morning. Before we even proceed, there's a request that we write the names of the organizations that we come from in our gadgets that help that helps people who are managing us to know exactly who's on the platform. Please let's do that. Honourable members, I'll be chairing this session. Honourable Mahlangu, good morning. She's on the platform, but she's definitely not feeling well. But she has joined in. Honourable Maswangani will be joining us a little bit late. She is involved in another meeting, but I think we will be able to proceed. Before we do that, let me check with you, Lubabalo. Are there any apologies?
Thank you, Chairperson. From the Select Committee on Appropriations, Chair, we have only one apology from Honourable Mr. Chairperson. And also from provinces, we received an apology from Gauteng with respect to Honourable Park Tau. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Let me correct that one. Let me also welcome the the oral members from MECs from the provinces. My apology. You are also welcome, oral members. Let me check. Alan, any apologies from your side?
No apologies from the Standing Committee on Finance, Chair.
Okay, thank you. Darren?
Chairperson, we have one apology from Mr. Sheikh Imam at Standing Committee on Appropriations.
Thank you. All members, as you saw in the documents that you received, today we are going to have a presentation by the Financial and Fiscal Commission. Good morning, Dr. Mbava and your colleagues and other commissioners. And then we'll also have a presentation by the Parliamentary Budget Office. Dr. Janchis, good morning, and your colleagues. I think what we'll do, we'll give each one of you, starting with the FFC, 30 minutes, and all members are very strict with time today. I see that about 86, 87 of us on the platform, so it's very important that we keep to the time. And then after the two presentations, then we'll allow interaction and deliberations on the presentations that would have been made. And then after that, also allow the presenters to respond on some of the issues that would have been raised by the oral members. Good morning and thank you very much. I will start with the FFC. The time is 5 minutes past nine, and 30 minutes each. So I'd expect that by 5 minutes past 10, you are all done with your presentation.
Recording in progress.
Honourable Ryder, please.
Morning, Chair. Thank you very much. Just on the apologies, you moved off fairly promptly, but there is going to be a simultaneous sitting of the NCOP, which clashes with this meeting. I do have a responsibility in there, and I will need to leave this meeting for about a 15-minute period just to fulfill my responsibilities in the House. So just if you can note that apology as well, please.
Thank you, Mr. Ryder. That will be noted. Any other?
There is Honorable Karim as well, Chair.
Honorable Karim, please come in. Honorable
yeah,
Chair.
I wanted to say there's a generic apology for all the members from the NCOP side who are here for this morning. The programming committee is aware of that. So Mr. Ryder can, of course, go when he needs to, and anybody else is participating, but otherwise we are all acknowledged as only joining them after 12 o'clock in the plenary. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you so much, Honorable Karim. Dr. Mbava and the team, please come in.
Morning, Chairman.
Sorry, I see the hand of Dr. Jenkins.
Good morning, Chairperson. Sorry, Chairperson. I just wanted to plead for a little bit of more time. We are asked for a bit of more time, at least 40 minutes, because we had prepared the presentation with the hope that we get just 40 minutes, Chair.
Okay, let's see how far we go, but I think you can save a lot of time also, Doctor, about leaving most of the introduction about what PDO is responsible for,
yep,
and so on and so forth.
Yep.
You remember we've been around now for more than 2.5 years, so we sort
absolutely
of made, right? Okay.
Thanks, Chair.
I saw that, and I just thought you can save more time on that, but let's see how far we go. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Mbava?
Yes, good morning, Chair. I am available on the platform, Chair.
Yeah, I was saying, please start.
Oh, okay. Thank you so much, Chairperson. Good morning to honorable members and to yourself, Chairperson. As a Financial and Fiscal Commission, we are here to present our recommendations on the medium-term budget policy statement as presented by the Minister of Finance recently. In terms of the Money Bills Amendment Procedure and Related Matters Act, which requires parliamentary committees to consider any recommendations of the Financial and Fiscal Commission when considering money bills. It is also made in terms of the FFC Act as well, which requires the Commission to respond to any requests for recommendations by any organs of state on financial and fiscal matters. Chairperson, our submission today will essentially touch on various aspects on the macroeconomic environment and fiscal policy, the economic overview and prospects, tax proposals and the revenue outlook, the in-year adjustments, and then the adjustments at provincial and local government, the fiscal risks, public sector wage bill, and finally, Chairperson, our recommendations as well. Without wasting too much time, I would like to hand over to the researchers to take us through the presentation, and then I will come in towards the end to do the final recommendations. Chairperson, thank you.
Thank you, Chair, and good morning to Honourable Chair and Chairs of the committees and Honourable Members. South Africa actually in this MPPB has received its good fiscal fortunes, and the ultimate broad thrust of our submission today is that we should not squander this good opportunity of fiscal fortune, and we encourage that the government continue its to remain on course, be consistent fiscally to its policy and stance, and ensuring that fiscal credibility and maintaining fiscal sustainability. I think we only have to look to the recent examples in Britain that to understand really what it means to be not fiscally credible. It has all sorts of other very negative implications indeed, both fiscally as well as politically. In terms of the various bills, we however note the great fiscal risks associated with the drawdowns and the demands that really comes very rather surprising, especially the demands of the SOCs, transports, the special appropriation bills, and overall, as I said, the fiscal fortune has not been squandered, but we need to be very vigilant continuously going forward in deciding what to do, what to make, how to make good use of this still sort of revenue windfall and overrun that we receive, and that's unlikely to remain for the long term. And hence the choices today in this MTPPS is of most importance. Then let me hand over to the researchers and to Thando Nkozo. Mr. Thando Nkozo, I will take you through the first set of slides and other researchers. Team, let's keep it under 30 minutes as the chair has already indicated.
Thank you, Chair, and good morning, Chairperson. Good morning, honorable members and colleagues who are present on the platform. I'm going to be taking you through the first two sections of the presentation, basically looking at the macroeconomic environment and then looking at the fiscal policy aspects. So in terms of the macroeconomic environment, what we note is that there has been a contraction in the second quarter of 2022, and this is follows two consecutive quarters that recorded positive growth. So what we're noting is that the economic growth has reverted to pre. Just want to say with regards to that is that this is concerning given the importance of growth in debt stabilization. So in terms of economic growth outlook, we see that global factors and structural domestic constraints are expected to keep the economy growing below 2% over the medium term, with no meaningful impact on poverty, inequality, and unemployment levels. The energy crisis, as honorable members will be aware, is deepening. What we note is that Eskom has implemented load shedding amounting to more than 90% of the entire 2021. And we just want to say that the intensified load shedding is threatening growth recovery from the contraction that has been recorded in the second quarter of 2022, because electricity is a key input to the production process. With regards to the inflation rate, we note that the inflation rate has breached the upper limit of the 3 to 6% South African Reserve Bank inflation targeting range, and the response from the bank has been that they've hiked the repo rate by a cumulative to 275 basis points, and this comes at a cost to economic growth. We also want to note that the pending grey listing of South Africa by the Financial Action Task Force, which we think will negatively impact investment and potentially trigger capital outflows, and that the rising cost of living is resulting in protracted wage negotiations that are above inflation, that result in above inflation salary increases, and also massive losses to the economy. Next slide. So in the next slide, we look at revenue and the expenditure side. So with regards to revenue, what we want to say is that the commodity boom has resulted in windfall mining profits and revenue overruns. And what we also note from the 22 MTPPS is that the primary budget surplus has been projected for the year 2023-24 for the first time in 15 years. And now this, we think, is important for debt stabilization processes, because broadly speaking, if the interest rate is higher than the economic growth, a primary fiscal surplus is required to stabilize or reduce debt to GDP ratio. We also note that debt will stabilize earlier and at a lower rate than the 22 budget, and the budget deficit will narrow, implying that the fiscal metrics are indeed heading in the right direction. So with respect to expenditure, what we note is that additional spending has targeted health, education, safety and security and infrastructure investment. And what we also want to bring to the attention of the honourable members is that the COVID-19 social relief of distress grant was extended by a year, and this implies that there is still no permanent and comprehensive solution to social security for the vulnerable. We note that the windfall revenue will not fund permanent spending increases, but will address only critical issues at strategic SOEs. And this we think is plausible given the temporary nature of the windfall. With regards to the wage bill, we see that no wage bill increase is assumed for the next financial year. Only 3% increase has been penciled in for this year. But what we note is that the public salary negotiations are ongoing. And this to us means that there is uncertainty around the issue. With regards to the financial support, that while these are vital, they constitute a credit rating risk. The issue on ESCOM's debt, we note that transferring up to two-thirds of ESCOM's debt to government's balance sheet is necessary to make ESCOM fundable. But what we note is that it will increase government debt. Lastly, we are saying that the poor financial health of most SOE constitute a fiscal risk in the form of contingent liabilities. Next slide. So coming now to the global GDP overview and prospects, the graph on this slide shows the growth profile of the global economy between the years 2021 and 2023. What we note is that global growth is forecasted to slow down significantly from 6% in 2021 to 3.2% in 2022 and 2.7% in 2023. And this is the weakest growth profile since since 2001, if we exclude the impact of the global financial crisis and that of COVID-19 pandemic. And this means that the risk of global recession has increased. And then lastly, what we just want to say, the cost of living crisis, the tightening of monetary policy, and the war between Russia and Ukraine, as well as the lingering impact of COVID-19 pandemics, are all weighing heavily on the global outlook. Next slide. With regards to the global inflation rate, the graph on this slide shows the global inflation between 2020 and 2024. So the just two points that we're making. The first one is that the global inflation is projected to reach 10.1% in the second quarter of 2022 and peak at 11% in the third quarter. And then lastly, we're saying that high inflation and lower growth forecasts constitute a global stagflation risk, which simply means that we will see a slow economic growth and high employment coexisting with high inflation. Next slide. So now looking at issues of domestic GDP, South Africa's GDP quarter on quarter percentage changes between the second quarter of 2019 and the second quarter of 2022. So what is worth noting is that the contraction in the second quarter of 22, as we've already alluded to, two successive quarter of expansion, and that's affecting both primary and secondary sectors. And this is important to note because these sectors include the key sectors, agriculture, mining, and manufacturing, that are critical for job creation. And then lastly, we just want to say the underperformance is primarily attributed to insufficient and unreliable electricity supply and the deteriorating infrastructure, as well as monetary policy tightening globally and domestically. Next slide. So when it comes to inflation in South Africa, what we see is so the graph on this slide shows monthly consumer price index year on year rates between January 2021 and September 2022. The takeaway message from this slide is that the inflation, as we've already alluded to, was largely within the Reserve Bank's inflation target range of to 6% over this period. But from May 2022, inflation breached the upper band of the range and peaked at 7.8 in July. And then the bank responded by hiking interest rate, as we've already said. But we just want to make the point that the hiking of the interest rate by 275 basis points was a response to stabilize the increases in prices that are primarily driven by supply constraints, thus risking hard lending. Next slide. So the last slide on this section relates to issues that pertains to unemployment. The graph on this side shows the quarter-on-quarter unemployment rate between the second quarter of 2015 and the second quarter of 2022. We just want to note that the unemployment growth rate continues to lag GDP growth, therefore translating into high levels of unemployment, and that the number of unemployed persons increased by 132,000 to 8 million in the second quarter of 2022 relative to the first quarter. The official unemployment rate is sitting at 33.9%, reflecting the fact that we really have an unemployment crisis that warrants significant interventions in the form of structural reforms. Thank you, Chair. I'll hand over to my colleague, Notolo, who will proceed with the second part of the presentation.
Thank you, Thando. Good morning, Chairperson and Honourable Members. I'll be taking you through sections 3 and 4 of the presentation. This section deals with tax proposals and the revenue outlook. Percentage of GDP. Due to improved revenue estimates, the tax to GDP ratio is projected to increase from 24.9% of GDP in 2021-22 to 25.4% by 2025-26. Although the upward revisions of the revenue estimates are encouraging, we note that revenue could decrease if power cuts escalate, if global growth slows further, or if the Russia-Ukraine conflict intensifies. Next slide, please. With respect to main budget revenue and expenditure, main budget revenue is expected to increase to 25.5% of GDP in the current year due to higher revenue collections, and is projected to average 24.9% over the medium term. Main budget expenditure, which includes debt service costs, is expected to reach 30.3% of GDP in the current year, reducing to 28.3% by 2025-26. The projected moderation in main budget expenditure largely reflects fiscal consolidation measures which have been enforced over the last few years. And as a result of increased tax revenue and expenditure containment, the main budget revenue and expenditure gap is projected to narrow from 4.9% of GDP in the current year to 3.3% by 2025-26. Next slide, please. In terms of the primary balance and debt service costs, a primary balance surplus is projected from 2023-24, increasing in the following years. And this reflects government's commitment to fiscal discipline, which is in line with its stance in ensuring fiscal credibility and sustainability. However, debt service costs present an escalating risk to the fiscal framework over the medium term. Overall, the fiscal outlook has improved relative to the 2022 budget estimates due to higher revenue estimates from increased corporate income tax collections. As a result, the primary surplus is projected from 2023-24. However, uncertainty remains on whether the government will be able to control the growth in the public wage bill over the medium term. In addition, continued increases in tax revenues may not be feasible due to the low growth projections. Next slide. In terms of the recommendations from this section, firstly, the Commission welcomes the changes in taxation and the decision to use the revenue windfall to support increased allocation to pay off debt, increase infrastructure spending, allocate funds to reduce fiscal and economic risks, fund safety and security, as well as social services, including the one-year extension of the SRD grant. While the Commission acknowledges the poor state of SOCs, the in-year allocation erodes resources available for other policy priorities. and a sustainable solution for the management and performance of public entities by addressing capacity shortcomings, accountability failures, and corruption. And lastly, the Commission supports the proposed amendments found in the various 2022 draft tax bills. Although the amendments are consequential, several of them will assist in increasing tax revenues, mitigating fiscal leakages, and further improving the efficiency of tax collection by SARS. However, it's important to note that the high inflation and low growth environment make it difficult to increase revenue through tax increases. Therefore, the implementation of tax reform should be done in a way that doesn't harm growth. Next slide. So this section looks at the in-year spending adjustments, specifically the 2022 adjustment appropriation and special appropriation bills. In terms of the 2022 adjustment appropriation bill, total in-year spending adjustments amount to 13 billion. 7.45 billion is in respect of adjustments to vote appropriations. And of this amount, 6.3 billion relates to unforeseeable and unavoidable expenditure prompted by flood damage in KwaZulu-Natal and Eastern Cape, mostly directed to corporate governance and transport votes. Regarding expenditure earmarked in the 2022 budget speech for future allocation, 500 million is in respect of the Presidential Employment Initiative and will be focused on a digitization program for the Department of Home Affairs. Rollovers amount to 990 million, largely emanating from the Agriculture, Land Reform and Rural Development vote, as well as the Communications and Digital Technologies vote. And total declared unspent funds amount to 1.96 billion, primarily driven by the Social Development vote. Next slide. The 2022 Special Appropriation Bill proposes additional funding equivalent to 30 billion to three SOCs located across the public enterprises and transport works. 23.7 billion is to assist Federal in paying off government guaranteed debt, and 6.2 million is in respect of the public enterprises work, specifically to Denal and Transnet. National Treasury suggests that the proposed conditional annual allocations to these SOCs will reduce contingent liabilities and enable them to support economic growth and national security. However, the challenges of SOCs, their poor functionality, along with the persistent guarantees and bailouts, pose a significant risk to the fiscus. Next slide. In terms of the recommendations regarding the Adjustments Appropriation Bill, the Commission welcomes the financial support provided to assist in rebuilding damaged infrastructure and to support affected households. With respect to the Special Appropriation Bill, the Commission cautions against perpetuating. And in this regard, National Treasury must apply stringent conditions to the provision of this funding. Next slide. Looking at expenditure from a functional perspective, the largest allocation is in respect of the learning and culture function, followed by social development and debt service costs. In 2023-24, expenditure is projected to grow by 1.6%, mainly driven by increases to the community development function, followed by the economic development function and debt service costs. The Commission welcomes the priority afforded to community development and awaits further detail and finalization of additional funding for early childhood development, the finalization of a funding framework for higher education and training, and the policy decision regarding support for economically vulnerable working age individuals. Next slide. In terms of the recommendations, firstly, the Commission welcomes the prioritization of growth in funding to the community services function. Considering the numerous municipalities that are in financial distress, the Commission advises national and provincial government, as well as Parliament, to exercise strict oversight over the use of these funds to ensure that there is no misuse. Secondly, while the Commission agrees with the decision to extend the SRD grant, policy certainty is required regarding the adoption of a permanent and sustainable solution to the provision of support for economically vulnerable working age individuals. And lastly, regarding higher education and training, the Commission reiterates its recommendation made in its response to the 2022 budget, calling for the finalization of a new funding framework for the sector, and advises that clear timelines and milestones be determined. Thank you, Chairperson. With your permission, I'd like to hand over to Shafika.
Good morning, Chair. honourable members and colleagues, I'll take us through the subnational changes in the Division of Revenue Amended Bill. Over the 2023 MTF, it is proposed that the provincial government will receive a total allocation of 1.7 trillion rand. This is a nominal increase of 2%. A year-on-year comparison shows that it is a slight decrease of 0.03%. However, this is projected to increase over the MTF. The PES and conditional grant changes marginally over the medium term by negative 2.5% and 4.3% respectively. These changes will negatively impact the provincial envelope. Next slide, please. Additional funding has been allocated for the repairs of key and basic infrastructure via the Education Infrastructure Grant and the Provincial Road Maintenance Grant. Eastern Cape and KZN is allocated 116.8 million rand for the repairs of schools that were damaged in the floods. An additional 1 billion rand was allocated for the road maintenance grant. The Commission supports the funding, but is of the view that the need to develop an update climate change and adaptation strategy, especially for provinces that are prone to natural disasters. Next slide, please. These will look at the changes to the local government framework. Local government has been faced with numerous challenges in the current year. There has been an increased focus on improving the challenges experienced by local government by developing key policy recommendations and strengthening municipal finance and governance. In assistance with the strengthening of municipal finance, we recently saw the approval of the Municipal Powers and Functions Amendment Bill. The Commission welcomed the amendment as it's in line with the FFC's 2020-21 submission of the Division of Revenue. The Commission also noted and welcomes the review of the conditional grant system in the relation to the rollout of infrastructure building capacity and providing operational support. This slide provides us or illustrates the real growth trend for local government equitable share. As we can see, the local government allocation is set to increase from 87.3 billion rand in the current financial year to 109.4 billion rand in the outermost year of the MTF. However, this is a marginal annual average real increase of 3% over the MTF. The Commission is concerned that the sufficiency of the allocation may negatively impact small and more rural municipalities as many cost drivers of service delivery increases by more than inflation. Next slide, please. This slide shows the real growth trends for conditional grants over the MTF. Over the MTF, municipalities are expected to receive 167.8 billion rand in the form of conditional grants. In real terms, the current allocation increased by 10%. However, this growth trend does not persist over the MTF, with the trend showing negative real growth in the outer years. The Commission welcomed the sharp increase in the conditional grant allocations in the current financial year, given that the bulk of conditional grants to municipalities are infrastructure related. Next slide, please. The Commission notes the shifting of the disaster funding between the spheres of government. In principle, the Commission supports the grant of immediate disaster response. However, the Commission would caution that this process does not resolve the challenges engulfing financing and management of disasters in the intergovernmental relations, as conditional grants for disasters are ex post allocation. The Commission also notes with concern the reprioritization of the 100 million rand from the Neighbourhood Development Partnership grant from the direct to the indirect component. The Commission here would like to reiterate its previous stance on this matter, highlighting the need for the principles to be in place and a systematic and transparent process to guide the reclassification and shifting of grant funding from direct to indirect and vice versa. Next slide, please. This brings us to the recommendations. Regarding the provincial allocation, the Commission reiterates the recommendations made in the 2021 MTBPS submission that gives expenditure moderation comprehensive reports should be compiled by the different government departments, indicating how such moderation is likely to affect aspect service delivery supports the 2022 Division of Revenue Bill amendments for provinces. It recommends that the grant framework for Part A of Schedule 7 grants be improved in grant efficiency, appropriateness and effectiveness. With regards to the local government aspect, the Commission recommends fundamentally reviewing the local government transfers, especially for the vertical perspective of the division of revenue, taking into account factors such as geography, rurality, and the people. And lastly, the FFC would like to reiterate its previous recommendations for the government to develop a policy framework for municipal disaster financing. Thank you. I'll hand over to Jehani now.
Thank you, Shafika. Good morning, Chairperson, honourable members and colleagues. On the fiscal risks, we highlight three main risks to the fiscus. Firstly, debt management. In South Africa, the stock of debt and debt service costs are still extremely high, undermining the macroeconomic strength and sustainability of our public finances, especially amidst sluggish economic growth projections over the medium term. The sustainability of the public finances may require a reduction in the stock of debt, as opposed to merely stabilization, which would necessitate larger primary surpluses to improve the GDP growth differential dynamics. Importantly, debt service costs are still high and are expected to increase over the medium term, which crowds out expenditure on key functionality. Next slide, please. The second major fiscal risk we highlight is contingent liabilities, which pose a significant risk to the fiscus because when they materialize, so do additional spending pressures, adding strain to the fiscus. And this risk is really elevated by the fact that many SOCs continue to rely heavily on government guarantees to sustain their weak financial positions. Government guarantees as a proportion of GDP has more than doubled over the past decade, and ESCOM remains to be the largest long-term risk to the economy, accounting for 78% of all government guarantees. This downward trajectory that we see in the graph of contingent liabilities and government guarantees as a proportion of GDP will be difficult to attain with the weaker growth projections that we have over the medium term. And then finally, the risk of inflation and monetary policy tightening. High inflation amidst weak economic growth is a risk to the fiscus because it can lead to stagflation. In 2022, the upsurge in inflation was driven by supply-side factors due to the ongoing war in Ukraine, which triggered severe economic sanctions and global supply-side shocks, causing the prices of essential food products, fuels, and other commodities to escalate. In South Africa, we know that inflation accelerated to reach a 13-year high at 7.8% in June, increasing the cost of living and dampening South Africa's prospects of a quick economic recovery post-COVID-19. To keep inflation expectations anchored, the South African Reserve Bank hiked the repo rate over a number of months, and this pushed market lending rates up, increasing the cost of borrowing and slowing down consumer demand and growth, raising further concerns over the rising cost of debt and macro fiscal stability over the medium term. Next slide, please. Then we come to the public sector wage bill. Compensation of employees remains to be one of the most significant expenditure items from the fiscus, absorbing 31.4% of government revenue in 2022-23. And the decline of compensation as a portion of total expenditure that can be seen in the graph by about 3.1% is essentially insignificant to bring about the decrease in the quantum of the wage bill that is required to ensure a budget balance surplus. Next slide, please. The two key cost drivers of the public sector wage bill are increases in the number of employees on the one hand and increases in employee salaries on the other. And salaries in particular have increased over the past few years at a rate above the inflation rate. So the figure shows that the consolidated public service wage bill will grow at an annual rate of 3.1%. And while the government is committed to increasing the capacity in services such as education, health, and police, the Commission is of the view that this should be done within the constraints of the available budgets to avoid additional pressures to the wage bill. Next slide, please. Here we see the first figure shows that employee headcounts have generally been decreasing over the years, with the exception of the local sphere of government, which has seen a rise in the number of public sector employees. And the bottom figure shows the salaries that have been increased across all spheres of government, as well as across SOEs, with the highest salary bumps in, occurring at the provincial level. So together, these figures really illustrate that it is the increases in employee remuneration rather than increases in the number of public sector employees that is driving and putting pressure on the rising wage bill. That brings me to the recommendations for this section. Firstly, on the fiscal risks, the Commission supports and commends pro-growth fiscal consolidation that aims to stabilize and reduce government debt, reining in debt service costs. However, global and domestic risks remain and should be mitigated where possible. Therefore, careful attention must be given to the budget and debt financing strategy to slow the annual rate of growth of debt service costs and ensure that interest expenditure doesn't continue to crowd out the fiscal space. Secondly, on the fiscal risks, weak productivity in expenditure needs to be addressed to create job-enhancing, inclusive growth, the quality in expenditure, and also investment-enticing reforms. And the Commission has previously stressed that this would require addressing structural constraints in the economy. So reforms that address vulnerabilities to corruption, such as procurement reform, reforms that ensure energy security by enticing private sector investment and fast-tracking the unbundling of Eskom, as well as reforms that increase the competitiveness in the economy through reducing regulatory barriers are urgently needed. Proper expenditure management is also required to prevent fiscal leakages and fruitless spending. And then finally,
FFC, please wrap up.
Okay, just the final recommendation here before I hand over to the chairperson to wrap up is just that we reiterate the recommendation in its 2021 submission that the government should develop a long-term plan to incrementally address sustainability and unsustainability in the public sector wage bill. Thank you very much, Chair. I'll hand it over now.
In conclusion, the Commission welcomes the medium-term budget policy statement 2022 and recommends that the government continues to stay consistent in its policy stance towards maintaining fiscal credibility, ensuring fiscal sustainability to minimize economic risk. The Commission welcomes government interventions to support economic growth, noting that the economy's over-reliance on the global commodity price cycle constrains economic performance and several domestic factors, such as policy uncertainty, state corruption, and capacity and electricity outages are further undermining growth. New drivers and innovation instruments for economic growth, such as the gradual transition to a low-cost, low-carbon, and more reliable energy generation model are required to boost economic growth. The prioritization of growth-supporting expenditure, particularly infrastructure investment, remains key to enhancing inclusive growth. The Commission notes that state-owned companies continue to drain the fiscus, thus threatening the sustainability of public finances. The Commission appreciates the need to tackle state-owned companies' balance sheet weaknesses. However, the bailouts constitute a sovereign credit risk and threaten fiscal consolidation efforts. Meaningful financial operational governance and business model reforms are required to address state-owned companies' fundamental challenges comprehensively. The Commission welcomes the government's efforts to stabilize government debt earlier and at a lower rate. However, debt service costs remain very high, signaling the rising cost of borrowing and slow growth. Their debt financing strategy should be aligned with economic growth initiatives to slow down the debt service cost and ensure that interest expenditure does not crowd out critical spending in vital functional areas such as health and education. A growth-friendly fiscal consolidation exercise must be implemented to stabilize finances. Next slide. Next slide. The Commission welcomes the financial support provided to assist in rebuilding damaged infrastructure and support provided to affected households and the reprioritization of growth in community services funding. The Commission calls for strict oversight by national and provincial governments as well as Parliament over the utilization of public funds in the context where most municipalities are in financial distress and may require assistance in prudently utilizing public funds. The Commission notes the provision for the public wage bill increase for this financial year and calls for more comprehensive planning, including developing a long-term plan to address increases in the public sector wage bill and improve public sector productivity. The Commission notes the extension of the social relief of distress grant by a single year and recommends more policy certainty in permanently funding social security in a fiscally sustainable manner to support economically vulnerable citizens comprehensively. The Commission reiterates its previous recommendations with regard to the urgent finalization of the new funding framework for higher education and training and comprehensive reports by affected government departments indicating how budget cuts are likely to affect the delivery of essential services and how tighter budgets will be managed. The Commission welcomes the increases in the allocation to local government, noting that the real increases over the MTF period are minimal. The Commission cautions against adversarial politics in coalition councils and calls for people-driven decision-making. The Commission finally recommends programs and resources to capacitate new councillors, protection of the local government equitable share funding to retain the gains achieved in the progressive realization of basic socioeconomic rights and conditional grants. Thank you, Chairperson. Over to you.
Thank you, Dr. Mbava and the team. Dr. Jantis, let's see whether we can take it to 25 to 11.
Thank you so much, Chair, and good morning to all our members and colleagues on the platform. Thank you so much for the opportunity, Chair. I'm with the team on the platform. I would really appreciate the opportunity. I think I just want to go straight into our introduction slide just to emphasize the importance of our presentation is really around the comment around the fiscal framework, around fiscal proposed fiscal framework, but also looking at in terms of the extent to which it supports the government's goals of dealing with socio-economic issues, but also looking at how the extent to which it leads to fiscal sustainability, but also commenting on some of the potential revenue sources and some of the key priorities of government over time. I think I just want to quickly give context into which our presentation was presented in this regard. I think the main crux of the message that we noted, I have a video, I can see a message here is coming to me. The goal of government is to really deal with some of the socio-economic issues as stated in the Minister's speech, and really the midterm budget statement is really meant to deal with. I think our concerns, Chair and members, is that given the experience of the fiscal stance taken over the years, we are concerned whether the proposed would certainly lead to realization of these developmental indicators or at least improving developmental indicators set out in the document itself. We're concerned that the approach may even constrain, as we've seen over the years, economic activities and in some instances worsens the socio-economic indicators as they stated. We know the structural reform has been slow and we know that and our concern is that the benefits noted might not be realized as stated in the Act over the medium term. We're concerned around that because that really worsens the economic socio-economic indicators as stated. We further concern that the growth rate focus in the statement means the real GDP per capita and real investment is expected to remain below pre-COVID-19 over the MTBF. And also want to emphasize some of the socio-economic challenges, particularly looking at the studies around the poverty has worsened in many instances, particularly around food, children, and worse so for least developed provinces. It's very important to take into account. Special unemployment, but some of these long-standing diseases, global crisis, and many other issues, corruption, state capture, and so many other has really weakened households and community resilience. We request emphasize the importance of taking that into account. One of the particular example here is around the the fact that the COVID-19 has worsened some of the learning outcomes, particular in our case in South Africa, seeing that fewer children now have access to early childhood development. Next slide. We have raised concern over the years around the credibility of fiscal framework, which continue to raise, particularly, continues to look at risk in a more narrow way to the fiscal framework, as it focuses mainly on fiscal debt, fiscal targets, which are debt and deficit. We are concerned that the stance should actually go further and focus really more on dealing socioeconomic issues and boost aggregate demand in the economy, and that will trickle down to households in that regard. Fiscal consolidation has continued to increase socioeconomic issues or concerns and lead to more instabilities and a concern that as these some of these challenges, particularly around lack of investment in the economy, will lead to worsening of these socioeconomic indicators. Some of the challenges have been facing households even way earlier on, particularly around cost of living in South Africa, and we've seen that going even higher over the recent years. They also ignore the huge cost of the economy and the government associated with serious risks, as we've seen over the years. There's so many other risks which we feel should have been really taken into account in taking a stance in this regard. The performance of our economy, which predates the poor performance of the economy, predates the COVID-19 crisis due to really interrelated structural weaknesses in the economy and extreme levels of socioeconomic issues in South Africa. And really our concerns, our view, we emphasize the importance of taking these concerns or these dynamics in really thinking about fiscal stability going forward. It should also ensure resources for measures to transform structural economy and alleviate some of the concerns, socioeconomic issues in our economy. The extreme inequality is great constraint to economy. We've said this before, we continue to emphasize that the focus on dealing with inequality is very important because that really deals with the economy and the development of society as a whole. We say fiscal policy can be more effective tool to redistribution, as we've seen in the literature, in a society like ours, and by increase social security and can provide automatic stabilizer to risks and shocks into society and economy. Can also support economic development, transform, include diversifying economy and value-added industrialization and productive services in this regard. In short, chair members, fiscal policy can be an essential policy to move into a new, inclusive, more stable and sustainable economic development in our society. These are examples where social and economic returns to reduce inequality are high and will support fiscal stability. As we say, it has to take into account the societal dynamics in this regard. Performance with regard to investment, next slide. Performance with regard to investment, employment, creation, and increase in economic activity across the least developed provinces and regions have been very, very poor over the time. We've also provided some context to say budget has to be looked into the context of what are the priorities that we want to realize, and we provide some analysis on the status of the MTSF over time. And we are quite concerned that less information is reported by government departments on some of the achievements or some of the progress made in realizing MTSF. In particular, we look at priority two, such as issues such as the jobs month, progress around jobs fund, job summit, major mass employment stimulus programs. Some of these mechanisms have not been included or reported timely on many government departments. Economic intervention to support investment and exports are reported, but often without showing progress whether that's been realized. It's unclear from reporting whether support for district development initiatives, townships, rural enterprises, small enterprises is showing much results as expected. It's unclear when they are expected to start making noticeable contributions to the macroeconomic variables such as investment and employment and so many other things. The extent to which, so we are saying, chair members, the extent to which the lack of structural transformation of the economy, the level of concentration, market dominance, impedes success of growth economic plans, intervention should be really looked into quite in detail, and this should inform a lot of fiscal stance to take going forward. The extent to which structural reform will benefit the dominant business corporations and whether this will crowd out other businesses should also really be examined in this regard. Chair, I'll stop there and give Dr. Orlando to take us through the presentation and the rest of the colleagues will come. I'll come in later. Thank you so much. Nelia, do you want to come in? Thank you.
Thank you, Director, and good morning, Honourable Chair and members. Next slide, please. Members, the proposed medium-term spending priorities are to reduce debt while trying to support economic recovery. Medium-term changes to spending are in part driven by government's decision to extend the COVID-19 Social Relief of Distress Grant until March 2024 and to increase infrastructure spending over the medium term. Additional funding has been allocated for safety and security. This is to increase the number of police, boost the investigation and prosecution of serious crimes, safeguard South Africa's borders and seas, support the implementation of the State Capture Commission recommendations. Further allocations have been provided to address the shortfalls in compensation budgets, specifically in provincial education, retain additional health workers appointed during the pandemic and support the provision of free municipal basic services, rehabilitate damaged municipal infrastructure and address the backlog in the refurbishment of provincial roads. Function groups reprioritized and reallocated their budgets to fund cost pressures and urgent policy priorities within the departments and entities over the medium-term expenditure framework. Members, this diagram illustrates the change in spending priorities per economic classification over the medium-term strategic framework. So there is a clear shift in COE from 33.9% in 2019-20 to an estimated proportion of 30.8% in 2025-26. The current proportion is on 31.4% that government spend on compensation of employees. And the other shift is in capital assets from 4.3% in 2019-20 to an estimated 5.9% in 2025-26. Next slide. In terms of the changes to reprioritization in the proportions that government spend per function group over the medium term, the two main priorities of government is learning and culture and social development. Health, peace and security, community development and economic development basically receives the same proportion of the budget. The shift in basic education and post-school education can be attributed to the shift of the TVET colleges to post-school education. And some of the other shifts worth mentioning is the estimated lower proportion allocated to health and peace and security towards the higher proportions to community and economic development. Thank you. Next slide. And over to my next colleague.
Okay. Thank you very much, colleagues. I'm going to deal with the macroeconomic overview and risks to growth and development. We start with the global outlook and also how South Africa fits into this kind of global macro financial situation. UNCTAD, the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development, warns in its latest report that in October that tighter monetary and fiscal policy choices in advanced economies, here specifically the US and Western European countries, increases the risk of a global recession and a prolonged stagnation. This is important because they warn that these actions may inflict worse damage than the financial crisis in 2008 and the COVID-19 shock in 2020. These constraints on growth are in addition to the ongoing problems caused by the continued COVID-19 pandemic, the ongoing war in Ukraine, global supply chain problems, and high energy freight and fertilizer costs. There has been widespread implementation of higher interest rates to fight inflation by curbing demand, decreasing investment levels, and increasing unemployment. This has been happening in both developed and developing countries. At the same time, there's been a widespread return to fiscal austerity across the globe. So we've got this combination of increasing interest rates and decreasing government expenditure, or government spending less on social welfare, and this causing an ongoing problem that may actually lead us into a global recession. The other thing is that because the developed countries are increasing interest rates, particularly the US Fed, it's causing a flight to safety. We're getting massive outflows of capital from developing countries, including South Africa. So if you look at the South African Reserve Bank's monthly reports and you add it up and you look at the cumulative flows from January until August, where we've got data for, we're seeing that there's been cumulative negative non-resident total net purchases of shares and bonds. That means they've basically been selling off and moving their money out of the country. So we need to understand what's happening with interest rates within this broader situation, because South Africa and many other developing countries are quite open in terms of our relations financially, and we're open to these inflows and outflows. The impact of capital flows on developing countries induced them to increase interest rates, not only out of fear of inflation, but also to attract foreign capital flows. We see the money moving out and they're trying to get back in. South Africa generally attracted short-term capital flows. So this is into our equities, in our stock markets, in our bonds, private and public bonds, government bonds, et cetera, rather than FDI. The combination of higher interest rates and volatile cross-border capital flows pose a serious risk to macroeconomic stability in developing countries. South Africa is a country that's at risk because it has had annual current account deficits since 2003, except for the last 2 years related to decreasing imports and the commodities boom during the COVID period. This current account deficit has predominantly been due to net financial transfers and not, as often said in the media and even by National Treasury, because we import more than we export. In fact, if you look at the graph above and you look at the red versus the green, you'll see that the predominant impact has been the financial transfers on the current account. This is repatriation of profits, payments of dividends, and moving money basically out of the country on the, not only on the financial card of the balance of payments, but also on the current account. So taking into account this kind of macroeconomic and macro global financial macro analysis, we can argue that maintaining a primary fiscal surplus and reducing government debt will not improve South Africa's current account situation and prospects for growth because of the overwhelming impact and vulnerability due to destabilizing volatile short-term foreign capital flows and the need to have a high interest rate regime to maintain that. And so we need to look at South Africa's debt and debt situation, but also our prospects for growth and what fiscal policy is doing within that broader global situation. This is the kind of macroeconomic analysis we need rather than the kind of fairly superficial analysis worried about inflation and pushing up interest rates to solve that. In terms of South Africa's outlook, we see South Africa's economic outlook is over the medium term is poor, relatively poor. There's a limited support for economic development in the 2022 MPPS. And if you look at the graph below, we see the increase in infrastructure expenditure is offset by declining shares for the rest. So we're seeing basically the agriculture, innovation, science and technology, industrialization, exports and job creation and labor fares all going down and basically governments working to reallocate money rather than to support economic development overall by increasing the nominal and real budgets for these. So aggregate demand and investment all likely would remain low. The economic structure would remain highly concentrated and inadequately diversified. Therefore, efforts to fight inflation and reduce government debt levels will likely hurt small businesses and the poorest households much more than they help. To continue, we look at investment because the National Treasury bases much of its GDP growth forecast of the medium-term expenditure framework on higher investment. And we actually really worry about this because the National Treasury's track record on forecasting investment growth has been particularly poor. If we look at the graph on the right with the for 2019, in the budget review, they estimated 1.5% growth in gross fixed capital formation. The actual outcome was -2.1. So we're basically looking at a 3.6% misestimation in that forecast of what's happened. And that's been over a long period of time. I think there's been more wishful thinking than actual proper modeling and forecasting of inflation and over expectations of things like pledges to investment and those kind of things. So private investment has been below 12% of GDP since 2015, and despite the infrastructure fund launched in August 2020, not a single mega infrastructure project has occurred. Public investment remains weak at below 5% of GDP, each for general government and public enterprises, while private investment declined below 10% of GDP in 2021, well below the NDP targets of 10% and 20% of GDP respectively. A lack of state capacity to deliver infrastructure projects, as well as insufficient progress in addressing structural constraints, do not bode well for the fixed investment outlook. So thinking about the structure, we see improved market sentiment related to lower government debt levels and work on structural reforms is insufficient for economic recovery and growth. So the structural reforms proposed by National Treasury and accepted by government, they see the structural problems they're dealing with as electricity, inefficient network industries, high cost of doing business, and concentration, crime, and corruption. Now, what we're saying is that most of these that have been identified as structural weaknesses are actually symptoms of deeper, long-standing structural problems. So the structural reforms are treating the symptoms, not the disease. The structural problems arose in large part because of inadequate investment, technological upgrading, and employment in an economy with a large, extractive, outwardly focused, dominant corporations. A lot of the discussion and talking about structural reforms doesn't look at the economic structure and the role that large, dominant corporations play. So we talk about concentration, and we talk about ESCOM as being a monopoly, but we don't talk about every other sector of the economy. The economic sectoral structure is weak, with inadequately diversified industrial base that is too capital, energy, and carbon intensive, with low levels of value added. The financial sector may be sophisticated, but it has not been associated with productive investment and capital formation. In fact, it's been associated with misallocation of capital, particularly if we look at the period running up to the global financial crisis. And that hasn't changed much after the global financial crisis and over a long-term deindustrialization of the South African economy as capital's misallocated to other things. The sectoral reforms will not reduce the high levels of economic concentration across most sectors of the economy, including financial services, and the structural reforms may actually entrench structural weaknesses, including market dominance of corporations that have been dominating the economy. I'm going to hand over to my colleague Chepo to talk through the fiscal framework. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Suraj. Chairperson, honorable members, in terms of the fiscal framework, so relative to the February budget, the fiscal outlook has certainly improved due to higher than expected corporate income tax collections, specifically from companies profiting not only from high commodity prices, but also higher inflation and interest rates as well. So these would be companies operating in the mining, manufacturing, and financial sectors of the economy. And as a result of this revenue windfall, government is now expected to achieve a primary budget surplus in the 2023-2024 fiscal year, and this will be 1 year earlier than what the February budget had projected. Next slide, please. So while debt is also expected to decline due to the anticipated realization of the primary budget surplus, as well as higher nominal GDP, the risks still remain elevated. For instance, gross loan debt as a share of GDP is expected to remain around 71% over the medium term. I think it's also worth noting that the National Treasury also indicated that it will allocate some of the revenue windfall towards reducing the gross borrowing requirement. However, we caution that elevated long-term government bond yields coupled with low GDP growth certainly pose risks to government's current medium-term plans to maintain these sort of debt to GDP levels. As I conclude, Chair, I think Treasury's fiscal strategy begs two important questions worth exploring. The first is, should expenditure not increase to give more help to struggling children, to starving children rather than struggling communities, especially during a time where the country finds itself grappling with the cost of living crisis? The second question is, will more expenditure and debt perhaps not earn large future returns, especially if it's spent on things such as
building resilience, reducing risks, but while at the same time boosting aggregate demand and GDP. I think this is important, especially given a time or during a time where business confidence to invest in the South African economy remains low. And we ask questions about where will growth come from in this current environment. Thank you.
Good morning, Chairperson and all. I'll continue on from here. So here what we wanted to speak about is really to indicate that few revenue raising mechanisms are proposed in the medium term, although as we heard in the budget and the budget speech, that the focus is on trade-offs. And so the question that must be asked is why are there no measures introduced to ensure that we maximize our domestic resource mobilization so that we can be able to finance the public expenditure that is needed for a developing country like ours. We see that revenues will exceed non-interest expenditure, but at the same time, we see real declines per capita in spending on the fundamental sectors, including education and health, which are proposed as priorities over time. We'll show this in a later slide. We can see that revenue is increasing over the medium term, even though there are no proposals for alternative measures, except, for example, the carbon tax. But it's important for us to note that tax is an important tool for redistribution in our society. As we know, South Africa is deeply, deeply unequal. And so the question is, how does the current budget propose measures to think critically about redistribution in this context? But also here to emphasize that there's a two-way relationship between what we consider as our tax base and high levels of poverty, unemployment, and inequality. In a context that you've got high poverty, inequality, and unemployment, it also means that your tax base will be declining over time. So how can we use the fiscus to deal critically with these issues of high unemployment, poverty, and inequality to then grow our tax base and our revenue holistically? Next slide, please. So here we just show here that both the tax to GDP ratio and nominal revenues are now expected to be higher. But of course, there will be a decline over time. As we know, the commodity boom will not last forever. But not only that, other profits that are being derived from in the financial sector, for example, due to the high interest rates, will fall off eventually if the interest rates and so forth change. And so we need to think about exactly how these things will lay out over the next couple of years, but critically to show that, in the outer years, 2022-23 and 2023-24, of course, the gross tax revenue growth declines, which then begs the question of why are there no proposed measures to increase revenue, and are we okay fundamentally with what has been proposed? Of course, VAT and fuel levy are lower than expected, but that is obviously because there was a relief that was provided in terms of fuel levy, as we know earlier in the year. Next slide, please. So the question here is, are there additional sources to increase revenue? And we've included a slide in the additional slides, which shows that South Africa actually has a relatively broad tax base compared to most middle income countries, which is contrary to what is broadly indicated. And so the question is, how do we maximize on our already broad relative tax base? And so we need to be thinking, I'm hearing someone in the background.
Honourable members, please mute your mic and let's allow the presenter to continue with her presentation. Thank you. Apologies for that, ma'am.
No, it's okay. Thank you. And so when we think about maximizing domestic resource mobilization, we not only need to think about progressive tax reforms, and of course tax is usually the discussion around revenue, but how can we leverage development finance, thinking about how to finance through our existing institutions, and also non-traditional monetary policy tools beyond interest rates. So we know that money supply can be managed through other instruments and not just interest rates management. And so how do we think about these measures to maximize the domestic revenue within our country? We also note that there's been significant reforms by SARS to maximize tax revenue collection, which will welcome. And so what are the areas of possible, interventions that we can implement? So we see that that in the UK and so forth, in the EU, there's been some implementation of windfall taxes, which is something that has been discussed in South Africa as early as 2012. How can we tax additional excessive profits that are derived from the windfalls, but also talking about excessive profits. Yes, some of the profits are being led obviously by inflation, but also there are companies that are really taking advantage of this moment and, you know, profiting more or including excessive pricing so that they can get more profits. So how do we tax that additional profits that are being made? We've also here had this to think about digital taxation, which has been a global discussion, yet no consensus has been reached. So how do we as South Africa think about taxing these large multinational and digital firms, which are obviously deriving value from our shores or within our shores, and also thinking about systematic reviews to tax incentives. How do we remove some of the ineffective tax incentives, which are effectively driving down the effective tax rate of companies, what companies actually pay in tax versus the statutory rate. But also lastly, to think about progressive measures to tax wealth. As we know, again, as I emphasized, there's great deep inequality in wealth within our country. Next slide, please. I'll hand over to my colleague.
Thank you, Busi. Next slide, please. So members, we've spoken about the changes over the time in the proportion spent per capita, but the real expenditure per capita shows that in 2016-17, total real expenditure per capita was 23,116. And by 2025-26, this will be declined to 22,964. In the NCPPS speech, it is stated that government is prioritizing education and health. However, proposed real spending declines over the medium term for both of these areas. Learning and culture decreases from 5,850, previous slide. Learning and culture from declines from 5,840 in 2022-23 to 5,590 per capita in 2025-26. And in health, it actually decreases from 3,373 in 2022 to an estimated 3,146,000 per capita in 2025-26. Next slide. So members, some of the in-year adjustments that we just want to note is in terms of the consolidated expenditure, you can see that 48 billion has been added in the revised estimate, and that is mainly due to the payments for financial assets, and that was indicated in the Special Appropriations Bill and others. In terms of the learning and culture, the revised estimate increased by 5.9 billion. Peace and security, we've spoken about, that's also a priority, increased in the current financial year by 6.9 billion. Economic development has actually decreased by 4.2 billion. And that is mainly in the economic regulation and infrastructure departments. Next slide. So in terms of changes to the consolidated expenditure for economic classification, again, it's clear that payments for financial assets and liabilities received the biggest increase in the current financial year. And then in terms of compensation of employees, 10.6 billion has been added to the current budget. But members, to note is that the increase in 2023-24 is only 2.5% from last year's budget, and that might not be enough for the next financial year. And then in terms of debt service costs, the current financial year, there was an increase of 5.9 billion. And it increases by 10.1% in the next financial year from the previous budget. Provinces and municipalities was increased by 3.9 billion, and there we see an increase of 10.8% in the next financial year from the previous budget. The other increase that we've indicated, which is also a priority, is in terms of capital spending. But in the current financial year, there was a decrease of 6.5 billion since the 2022 budget, but we are expecting to increase that budget by 10.8% in 2023-24. So members, just a closer look at the structure of the wage bill. Next slide. So the wage bill, which needs to be considered, I think we should consider some of these issues that we are raising. In terms of the national public entities, in that green section on the slide, it actually is almost like an additional level of government. So compensation of public entity employees is generally not included in the budget numbers. They are mainly included in transfers. But to note is the reduction in the headcounts on the national level of government by 1.3%, but headcounts in public entities actually increased by 1.2%. So also to note is the unit cost in public entities, which is the highest in all of the levels of government. If we look at the average unit cost in 2021-22 on a national public entity level, it's 534,000 per year, where on a national level, it's only 460,000 per year. So this is just an illustration of that we must really monitor and look at the detail of our COE if we really want to make a difference, so that we don't get a situation where we actually reduce it on the one level but increase it in another level of government. Next slide. Members, although government has prioritized spending on the infrastructure, the envisaged outcomes never actually realizes. Between 2018-19 and 2020-21, actual spending was below 70% of the amount budgeted. The revised estimate for 2022-23 is that government will spend 91.6% of the revised budget, and infrastructure is again a priority over the medium term, increasing to 115.5 billion in 2025-26 from 77 billion in 2022-23. If government is serious about infrastructure spending, we need to ensure that all efforts to improve spending needs to be implemented. In the 2019-2024 medium-term strategic framework, they actually provide for the design and implementation of a capacity building program that was supposed to be implemented by March 2021-22 for the procurement and delivery of infrastructure. The progress that actually has been reported on this outcome is that the provincial public works capacity building programs are aligned to the skills pipeline interventions. So I think we really need to do more or to find out more about this program to ensure that we really implement infrastructure that we actually envisaged over the medium term. Next slide. I will hand over to my colleague to present the challenges that we actually found when we did our analysis on the medium term strategic framework.
Thank you, Nilia. Honorable Chair, honorable members, so with everything said, the main thing is how does that contribute in terms of the implementation of the NDP through the implementation of the MTSF? So as PBO, we embarked on a project of analyzing the performance on the current MTSF, the 2019-2024 MTSF, looking at the seven priorities. So we analyzed five of the performance on the five priorities, and what we found some challenges when we looked at all of them. Like one, we have underperformance in most of the targets in all the five priorities that we analyzed, and performance indicators to measure the performance on the MTSF are not presented in departmental APPs, which lead to oversight bodies cannot determine the progress made on the priorities if regular reports are not available. And also, if priority indicators are not reflected in APPs, government funds may be allocated to outputs that are not prioritized. So if the MTSF indicators are not reflected in the APPs, it will also not be audited. And some of the departments also introduced several new indicators in the MTSF, which do not have historic information or systems in place to measure the outputs. And reporting on the specific indicators are not in line with the target set. Department reports that are reports that have been produced on specific targets. And these reports are submitted to cabinet and are however not published and not available to the public or to oversight bodies like parliament. Next slide. So like I said, we looked at five of the seven priorities of the MTSF. And one of them that we analyzed is priority two, which focuses on economic transformation and job creation. So the findings from that priority two is as follows. So between 2019 and 2020, and 2021 and 2022, 2.95 million work opportunities have been created through the EPWPs. So this is against a target of 5 million for 2024. And performance on the measures of implementation of interventions such as the Job Summit, the Mass Employment Stimulus Progress, and the Operation Pakistan have not been included in the relevant departmental APPs. So the Mass Employment Summit Program has a target of 800,000 job opportunities by 2021-2022, and there is no reporting on that currently. And Operation Pakistan has a target of 402,950 by 2024. So since they are not included in the departmental APPs, it's difficult for oversight bodies to track the performance on such programs. And to report progress on the investment for accelerated growth, the Department of Trade, Industry and Competition mainly produce progress reports on their interventions without showing progress on targets set for the planned output. And the Department of Communications and Digital Technologies indicated that they will focus on fast-tracking the broadcasting digital migration. So funding has been allocated to establish broadband access for households' connectivity, but progress to ensure that 80% of the population will have access to the internet by 2024 or the competitive reduction in data costs have not been reported in the departmental APPs. Next slide. So in terms of small businesses, township and rural enterprises were supported to the value of 694 million in 2021-2022. And this is against a target to support 100,000 competitive small businesses and cooperatives by 2024. Progress consolidated report on the 70,063 competitive SMEs and cooperatives supported by EXCO in 2021 and 2022. So separate reports are produced on the support to SMEs and cooperatives. This is against a target to support 100,000 by 2024. The department supported 6,315 startups, youth businesses financially and non-financially in 2021-22 against a target of 10,000 per year over the MTSF. So a localization policy framework, including the listing of product brands produced by SMEs and cooperatives, have also been developed. So DPE produces progress reports on legal separation and ESCOM roadmap and reformed electricity supply industry. The specific status for the unbundling process has not been presented in the quarterly performance report on the APP. So we have no idea what is happening in that respect. So current progress shows that a renewable energy sector master plan report is under review. The GAF master plan is undergoing stakeholder consultation, and the completion of the integrated plan is estimated to be completed in 2023-2024. This is against the target that all master plans are supposed to be finalized by 2021, and we're in 2022 already. They're still under consultation. Next slide. I'll hand over to the next person.
Thank you, Dr. Skatana. I'll try to be quick as we don't have much time in our hand. Honorable Chairperson and members, the state-owned enterprises continue to pose a significant concern for public finance management, as in most cases, it relies on government to receive funding and to continue finance their operation. So the government debt reduction strategy is partly offset by the materialization of the contingent liability. The minister announced in the MTPPS that government plans to take over a significant share of the Eskom 400 billion debt, and it said it will also apply the strict condition. Through the special appropriation bill, the government proposed using the a portion of the windfall tax amount, which is amounting to 30 billion to cover the contingent liabilities of the SOEs that need immediate injection of fund. 23 billion will be allocated to SANRAL. A total of 5.8 billion will also be allocated to Transnet, and 204 million is allocated to DENE. Government also indicated that funding to SOE will come with a strict pre and post-funding condition. For instance, DENEL is yet to meet the condition to access the 3.4 billion, and also Land Bank remain in the financial distress as it hasn't met the condition to merit the 5 billion which was allocated to the entity in the previous budget. Next slide. This slide, in a nutshell, it shows the Eskom cost structure versus its revenue. There are three components of its cost structure. There is primarily energy cost, which includes the coal, water, and diesel. The second one is the employee cost. And the third one is other costs, which include maintenance and the once-off items. So Eskom primary energy cost has been the major driver of Eskom operating cost. As we see in the late 90s, it was around 20%. And more than two decades later, in the year 2021, it's more than half the Eskom revenue. And this is a very likely mean that Eskom may require to increase the tariff in order to sustain its operation and to keep the lights on, or it will further require bailouts from the government. The other thing to note is the aging infrastructure, which also affects the transmission system, because from time to time, it needs maintenance, it needs upgrading, and the further investment is also needed in order to have a proper infrastructure for the Eskom. Next slide. South Africa has seen more load shedding in 2022 compared to the previous year, and Eskom has implemented its longest uninterrupted streak of load shedding in the year 2022 since it started its rotational power cut in the year 2008. So the announcement that government will take a portion of Eskom debt, we think it's an important move, as Eskom continue to provide electricity to about 95% of the electricity used in South Africa, and almost 85% of that electricity is from the coal mine. Eskom has had trouble in completing and bringing the line into Medupi and Kusile, with Kusile expected to be completed in the year 2025. And the rest of Eskom coal generation is old, and Eskom plans to decommission about 22,000 megawatts of generation capacity in the year 2035. That's my slide, Chairperson. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, colleagues. Chairperson, we will stop here. We took too much time. And thank you so much for the opportunity. There's conclusion slides, but we'll stop there to give us more time to ask questions. Thank you so much, Chair and members. Thank you.
thank you. Thank you, Dr. Taylor. Honorable members, let me see. Hello. Let me see by the show of hands I see Honorable Matafa.
Peters.
Honorable Peters. Honorable Muletsane. Okay, I'll end there.
Chairperson, good morning.
Yes, okay, that's fine. Let me have Honorable Matafa, Honorable Peters, Honorable Muletsane. Then I'll come to the other members. Honorable members, please, my request, can we try and time ourselves, there are many of us here. Can we have a three minutes rule, go to the questions, and we'll see how we fare. If we still have more time, we'll come back to you.
Only governing party MPs will struggle with 3 minutes at chair.
Okay, let's Honorable Matafa.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, Chair. Good morning, Honorable Members. Our guests from the FFC and POB, PBO. Chair, I only have two questions. I'm not going to be long. I'm going to disappoint Honorable Kwankwa. The first one, Chair, is on the issue of the reduction that we see in the division of revenue in relation to the allocations to provinces.
Matafa, you can switch off your
concern because in previous slide, tax collection.
I was saying you can switch off your video. I'm struggling to hear you.
Thank you, Chair. Is it better now?
Much better. Thank you.
No, thank you very much, Chair. No, Chair, I only have two questions. My first one is on the reduction that we see as far as the division of revenue is concerned, the allocation for provinces. I'm just interested to find out if whether from the FFC and the PBO, why the contradiction? Because in one of the slides, we are informed that revenue collection from corporate tax has increased. Is there any other reason that would have led to the reduction of allocations for allocations to provinces? Yes, I note there is a slight increase to municipalities, but I'm just interested to find out if whether, don't we think that this particular revenue collection would be sustainable in the long run? Because I also see that also in the MTEF, there is a view that there will be reduction as far as expenditure is concerned. The second one, Chair, it's the issue of economic growth. One issue that I have been raising many a times before on the issue of being an economy that is over-relying on global commodity prices. I'm happy that the FFC agrees with that view, and also the PBO on slide 18 emphasizes this particular point. Now, my question, Chair, is if whether has there been a study to consider other factors that can be seen as economic drivers other than stable low cost and low carbon electricity generation and infrastructure spend? Having said that, Chair, you will notice that when the President spoke of the Economic Reconstruction and Recovery Plan, he would have also put pillars, and these two pillars appear in those particular pillars, as the President was alluding to, what will be needed to take the economy on an upward trend. However, I have noted, and the FFC and the PBO can correct me, much emphasis is put on the issue of the electricity and infrastructure spend. And for me, representing communities and the majority which remains unemployed, I think the two that are critical are not given the necessary attention, which is the employment stimulus in order to create jobs and support livelihoods. And the second one, Chair, is the support to grow South African businesses. So I'm just interested to find out if whether from this adjustment, the MTF and MTSF, is there a view that we are then taking localization, industrialization, and export promotion seriously? Because the PBO states categorically clear that we are importing more than we are exporting. So basically, we are relying on international products that maybe some of them, I believe, given the size of the research institutions that we have in the country, can and should be producing locally. Is there a view that we are alive to these particular issues of economic growth, particularly the two aspects of employment and localization that I believe that are not given the necessary attention? Let me pause there, Chair. I only have those two issues. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Taff. Honourable Peters.
Thank you, Chairperson. May I switch off my video?
But we can hear you very well.
Yeah, but it has been shaking like the last time.
We love the bright and beautiful pink.
No, Chair, no. Chairperson, good morning, and good morning to all the members and the FFC and PBO. Chair, I for brevity, I would propose that I ask both the presenters or the teams the same questions, and they will decide which side. And I would want to rattle through these questions because I know that I'm a bit slow. I won't give preambles. I won't do anything. I heard a PBO answer one of the questions that I was going to ask, which is the reason for the higher than anticipated revenue collection. So I would also go on to say I've noted the focus on the extended SRD grant. I just want to know whether the presenters believe that or project further extensions. And I know that I've heard from the FFC as well as PBO on the possibility of a BIG or whatever it will then be called. I just want to know from them, do they believe that taxing the rich to contribute to this is something that is worthy being to be done? But also they raise the issue, especially the FFC, about the 1.8 billion unspent by the Department of Social Development, the mainly due to lower than expected SRD. I just want to put it here to the committee and the two agencies that there are many people who claim that they have applied but have not been approved, or whose claims doesn't go through with DSD and SASSA. What do you think should be done to be able to make sure that we don't have what is sometimes called savings by agencies and departments whilst people are going hungry, and this 350 would have been a good intervention. Also with regard to the Special Appropriations Bill, what does the FFC and a PBO suggest should be the stringent conditions that are attached to SANRAL and DENEL with regard to the additional money that they would be getting? The issue, I heard FFC speak about the low or that local government is the lowest in terms of the allocations. I would want to know from the FFC, what is their suggestion that can be done to make it possible that local government, despite the challenges that they have of skills of councillors and all that, that the allocation of local government as the sphere nearest to the people, they are the ones that feel the impact of the potholes and the infrequent supply of energy and all that. The presentation by FFC also speaks to climate change adaptation. I just want to find out from them whether the long-term mitigation scenario as projected by the Department of Environmental Affairs, that by 2025, South Africa will plateau in relation to their emissions. And I want to know whether the impact of the floods can be attributed to the inability of South Africa to reach its emission. There's talk of low cost, low carbon emissions. How does government, especially the FSC, how does government then explain to the community of South Africa that, and I've made my own quotation, we have coal, but it is said to be not good to provide you with much needed energy. Close quote. Is it something that is worthy to be told to South Africans that we do have coal, but we are unfortunately unable to provide you with the power that you need because we are told that the coal that we have is dirty. Chairperson, given another opportunity, I'll come back. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Honorable Mletsane.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning. And please pardon me for not switching on my video. The network is not strong where I am. Let me first start by welcoming the two presentations. My questions will go to both presenters. The presentation on MTBPS is quite about the Free State Jagersfontein disaster in terms of intervention or assistance. What are your views or comments about the silence of the Treasury on the Jagersfontein issue? Second question, the continuity of bailing the Eskom by Treasury. The Treasury continue to deal with the problem rather than the cause of the problem for permanent solution. Do you agree with the approach, or what is your view in terms of dealing with the Eskom problem? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honorable Mletsane. It's Honorable Kwankwa. Please, Honorable members, please take down your hands, those who have spoken. Thank you, Honorable Kwankwa.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. It would most probably this one be to the Parliamentary Budget Office. Pardon me for switching off the video. I'm participating while driving at the same time, Chair. Chairperson, I think that it has to do with the structural transformation versus structural reforms that need to be undertaken. I think it's slide 18 by the Parliamentary Budget Office. One of the issues I think that this parliament or government we have failed to do is to deal precisely with what they've cited there as the misallocation, saying the financial sector may be sophisticated, but it has not been associated with productive investment and capital formation. And this is associated with misallocation of capital and deindustrialization. Now, what kind of policy interventions would we need to put in place in order for us to address this thing? Because it has been a problem for the longest period, and it's something that needs to be addressed. Perhaps it's a question to the Parliamentary Budget Office. One of the slides also talks about the impact of fiscal consolidation and how it makes it unable for government to deal with some of the social challenges facing our country. Is it possible then to get a sense, because, you know, there needs to be an assessment of past consolidation episodes, their effectiveness, whether they have worked. Remember, there was a period after 2008 where we embarked on a counter-cyclical fiscal policy stance. And later on, obviously, for obvious reasons, we had to try to embark on a fiscal consolidation program. But to what extent have those fiscal consolidation episodes been effective in improving the underlying cyclically adjusted primary balance? To say the variables that it sought to influence, to what extent has it been effective, so that we can measure that performance against its inability and effective impact on our ability to make sure that we improve and provide for the social needs of our people. The other issue which strikes me here, Chair, slide 34 of the same Parliamentary Budget Office, where I think it's a failure on our part. where they talk about performance measures on the implementation of interventions such as Job Summit, the Mass Employment Stimulus Program, Operation Pakisa, which then they say have not been included in the relevant departmental APPs. It's something that we should take on board and make sure that we do, because then it means we have an Operation Pakisa, but we don't Pakisa, or we don't ensure that the government Pakisas after having adopted that Operation Pakisa as a problem. Chair, the Financial and Fiscal Commission talks about the unbundling of ESCOM. Yes, from an operational point of view, it makes sense to embark on that strategy. But could we also talk about the impact of that on the financial, on the balance sheet of ESCOM? Because now, instead of being able to source funding on the basis of a consolidated budget, rather a balance sheet which shows strength to the market, ESCOM is going to end up with a weak balance sheet because of the fragmentation that's going to take place. How can we mitigate that going forward? Because then it means ESCOM might not be able to source funding from the financial sector once that has happened. Thank you ever so much.
Thank you, Honorable Kwankwa. Honorable Okam.
Good morning, Honorable Chair, and good morning to all the colleagues and the presenters. Honorable Chairperson, what we've heard here this morning is again very worrying. If we hear or see in the presentation the words bailouts constitute a sovereign credit risk and threaten fiscal consolidation efforts. But we also hear that government guarantees have more than doubled in the last 6 years. It brings us to a point where we really have got to do introspection of what we are doing with state-owned enterprises. Sure, there will be a lot of the debt of ESCOM that will be taken over now. The big question is going to be, what will those stringent conditions be for ESCOM to be able to get this debt written off? We must remember that everything points to the fact that ESCOM still is under the hands of state capture, of the capturing of ESCOM itself. It's not only about the CEO, who is Mr. De Reiter, who I believe is not captured, obviously, but it's about the whole institution that has over the years become captured. Will ESCOM now all of a sudden be in a position where it can borrow more money and that then fall into the tentacles of the hands of the people that is still capturing ESCOM itself? We've got to look at that and got to make sure that whatever the money is that ESCOM can get now as a result of the writing off of this debt must not empower them to be able to get more debt that will be spent in the wrong way. We must create an environment, Honorable Chairperson, where that is conducive to attract investments. We are talking about an unemployment rate that is sky high, and we are looking at a public wage bill that takes up 31.4% of the budget. Now, that is very worrying as well, because the people that led us to be where we are still the people that are in that public service. There were no consequence management or very little consequence management over many years. So we are sitting with the same managers earning extremely high salaries, which make up a huge portion of the 31.4% of salaries that are going to the public sector wage bill. And we need to revise that. We need to look at what we are going to do in order to get proper people in, don't have cater deployment, which led to people being in positions which they could not manage. And that is why we are where we are. So we need to look at that in order for us to turn things around. We heard things this morning about infrastructure development. Now, that is all good. It must happen. But again, government's position should be that they are there to enable the private sector to thrive. Government must have this outlook that they must attract investments, that they must create an environment that everybody wants to come and invest into South Africa. But now we hear rumors of another state-owned company, but this time that it will be a company, state-owned, that will be involved in the infrastructure development. Now, again, that is very, very disturbing things that we are going to see that might happen. And I would like to hear what the FFC and PBO's opinions about that possible state-owned company with regards to infrastructure development would be. Thank you, Honorable Chairperson.
Thank you, Honorable Okam. Honorable Ryder.
Yes, good morning, Chair. Good morning, everybody. Thank you very much for the opportunity. I'll be as brief as I can. I'd like to just ask, so we are all expecting an infrastructure-led recovery. That's what the President promised us that we're going to have in the ERRP and the discussions around that. It seems that we're actually taking some money away from infrastructure in certainly if we consider the DORA and the allocation to provinces and local governments and how some of those shifts are happening. I'm not sure if this is an indication of an inability to fulfill the mandate given to them by the President and then, you know, affected by the Treasury. If we can have some comment from FFC, also from PBO, on that particular matter about the fact that we don't seem to be following through on promises made. So I'll leave some of the other comments for DORA later. But the one point that I want to make on DORA, so we've seen massive internal shifts. If you consider the overall effect of DORA, there's a minimal effect from the adjustments. But if you look at the internal shifts, there's a massive shifting of funds between projects, between departments, etc., and indicating that there may be a massive change in priorities, or there's been an absence of planning that's happened, and provinces are not coming through with what, you know, they initially intended and what they laid out at the beginning of the financial year. Again, if we can have some comment on that particular matter. So interesting from the FFC, the comments on the wage bill and the impact of it, saying that even on the 3% that's been projected going forward, the effort is insufficient to achieve the not even desired, the needed outcome. And I'd love to hear some comments on the impact of what, you know, because Starto have turned around and said, they're digging their feet in at 10% now because they've gone back to that position, and there is a genuine risk, certainly with the coming election, that there is going to be a substantially higher settlement from government. If FFC can just guide us a little bit in terms of the risk associated with that, certainly in terms of our debts, we're not going to have the expected debt reduction that has been much vaunted in the media and also in the presentations today. If a lot of that has to go towards settling the government wage bill, and certainly we're not going to have any more windfalls coming up in the next couple of years, noting the impact of the global recession, etc., which hasn't been mentioned today, and the consequent reduction in demand. And therefore the reduction in prices. So in the medium term, we're going to see, the problem with the wage settlement now is that it has a long-term effect and impact rather than just a once-off. And again, comments on that, please. There's been no mention today of grey listing at all and the impact that that may have on the medium term. And it's a risk that I think that is too great to ignore. Certainly, you know, having no comment on it, I think, and unless I missed it, but I was being quite attentive throughout. The PBO, there was a comment about high interest rates, and I'm quite concerned about that, you know, that narrative. If you're either buying into that narrative or propagating or giving that narrative additional oxygen, you know, we're sitting in a cycle at the moment where our interest rates are certainly on the up, but remain lower than they have been for quite a long time. The last time they were this low was around 2014, and before that they were substantially higher as well. So we've actually been in a period of very low interest rates, obviously to drive growth in the economy as a post-COVID recovery and during COVID recovery as well, to try and underpin the economy. So I'm a little concerned about the narrative that we're in a high interest rate environment. Certainly increasing, yes, but and compared to some of the more stable economies, it is really high. But I don't believe that we're in a high interest rate environment. There is room to act a little bit more, to increase them a bit higher. I think the Reserve Bank has probably acted quite responsibly. I think that was acknowledged as well by the FFC. To the PBO, I just wanted to appreciate the fact that you brought the entities into your calculations and your projections on the salary bill. I think that was really important and something that's often missed. So I wanted to appreciate that and just to point out that I think that the impact of state entities at all levels, not just at a national level, we have municipal entities, we have provincial entities as well, and the impact of those wages is quite big. My last and probably the biggest question I have as a representative from Gauteng relates to SANRAL and the e-tolls and the effectively cancellation of e-tolls and bailing out. So I just want to ask a question which might be deemed a little bit provocative, but good. The fact that SANRAL has stuck with bloody mindedness to this project to date, in spite of all of the advice that they received from the outset, going back right all the way back to, I think, 2013, 2014, around then, when this was first envisioned, they've stuck to the bloody-minded approach that they would continue with this, even when it was proven that it was not working. And I just wondered if the FFC and the PBO felt that there should be some sort of impact or effect on that. I don't know if it's fruitless and wasteful expenditure declared for all of the money that they've spent on the great presence that they've established in shopping malls across Gauteng at substantial cost, rental cost, etc. The cost of collection, sending out all of those bills that people have been using to light their bras with, and so on. Shouldn't there be some sort of a consequence for SANRAL as well? It looks to me like they're getting a total bailout and evading responsibility entirely. And I think that this is a bad decision that was led by them, by their senior management at the time, and I think that they seem to be escaping scot-free. I don't think that's appropriate. I think SANRAL should also be shouldering some of the financial fallout from their action or lack of action. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Ryder. You are on serious injury time, but I just let you finish your point. Honorable Sarupen.
Thank you very much, Chair. I'm going to try and do video today and hope that it stays stable so that you can see me. Chairperson, I think that my colleagues have covered most of what I want to say, except with regards to the proposed debt swap from particularly Eskom onto the government balance sheet. That would have the consequence of fundamentally changing the debt-to-GDP ratio. And that means that all of the projections we've been given by the Treasury and so on containing the debt to GDP ratio and bringing it down by 2024 is not taking that into account. I'd like to ask the FFC and the PBO if they've done any modeling on what the consequences would be to our debt to GDP ratio, as well as what it would do to the government bond markets when this debt to GDP ratio balloons as a consequence of the debt swap, as well as what it would do to the state's capacity to borrow to continue to fund essential services and infrastructure. We know that a large chunk of the state's work is funded through deficits and through borrowing. And if this debt swap would not completely destroy that, and I'd like to understand what the economic impact would be and if they've modeled that yet. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you so much, Honorable Sarupen. Honorable Kaiso.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. Honorable Chair, I just want to make a few comments here. Firstly, is to acknowledge all the positive elements of the presentation in as far as budget medium-term expenditure policy framework is concerned, especially with regards to the extension of the SRD and the potential of the budget consolidation, which seemed to be narrowing post 15 years. So it's something that shows we may be going somewhere. But quickly, I want to ask the FFC the following question, Honorable Chair. With regard to Eskom, it does seem that we, at some stage, when special appropriation was being made of 400 billion rand to Eskom, We did propose some conditions and on of which the Treasury have said it did those and it's monitoring them over a quarter with a report. But then with the extra strict conditions that will be proposed, I just want to find out from FFC, would this then be something that is effective than the ones that are existing, or are there any loopholes that you advise the committee to check on with the current conditions which were attached to that 400 billion rand, or what? Or do you expect any change in as far as those conditions were concerned, which will represent stricter than strict? And then secondly is on the crisis which predates the COVID-19. Here FFC just a general statement on the preconditions, but I fail to capture categorically what are those specifically preconditions which you could advise us are being ignored in as far as you are concerned. But here it's like your understanding as FFC is that the current measures which deals with the crisis are only dealing with in the context of COVID-19. So I want to unpack these other ones which are left behind. If you can just mention them, what are those conditions predates COVID-19, yourself as FFC, that you see they have now been left out, being issues that needs the Treasury to be taken or on board as we deal with the COVID-19 crisis presented itself. On the danger of the high interest rates, you pointed out to the danger posed by increase of interest rates. So I just wanted to get what is the advice on this matter, because it seems very serious in as far as you put it here. And the other point is that on the structural and structural transformation and visas structural reform, it does seem that FFC, you just made the two comparisons, but then I didn't get you actually what is it that you are recommending, because you are presenting as this, the other one, this is the other one. But I don't know what is the recommendation and as far as this is concerned, because it's obviously we are referring to one that is more liberal and the other one which is more of a positive change, a practical change or a scientific change. Now, on land bank, Chair, I don't know. It does seem that we have a problem in as far as the progress in as far as land bank is concerned, because one could imagine what has been happening over the past 2 years since land bank could not meet the conditions that are being required for it to access the money that has been allocated to them. It's not the only the problem of land bank, but I believe also the land users, and then especially the emerging farmers and small emerging farmers, they are also experiencing a very serious problem with regards to this accessibility of the money which was to be given to land bank, and the land bank is a failure as far as meeting the condition, and therefore prompt us to actually probe this matter with land bank or whoever that is role players in as far as that land bank is concerned. Let me pause as such up to this point, Chair, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Taiso. can I check Oral Matafa, do you have one question you want to add?
No, I am fine. Thank you very much, Chair.
Honourable Peters.
Thank you, Chair. Can I take the opportunity? Chairperson, I just want to ask both agencies again. Do they think that a 72% expenditure for compensation of employees in one of the provinces is sustainable? And what plan is the FFC talking about to address the unsustainability of the public sector wage? Also the issue now, Chairperson, lastly, the rejection of the user pay principle by South Africans, is there an alternative that the FFC can be recommending? And also, is the road accident fund or levy, fuel levy, an option for funding road infrastructure? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Robert Peters. Orum Letane, do you have a question? Want to add? Honorable Kwankwa? Anything from your side? Honorable Okam? Honorable Ryder? Honorable Sarupen? A pending question?
Nothing from my side, Chair.
Honorable Kaiso, a pending question?
Yes, sir. I just wanted to correct something here. It didn't go undetected. Honorable Khan talked about the problem of, I don't know why the problem of career deployment comes into this discussion, because if one was to hold a 3-second workshop, is that there is a difference between a performance agreement and a cadre deployment. So they should not be conflated here. A performance agreement is an instrument by which a person is a contract which is entered to by the employer and the official. So what follows then, it is the measure to assess that it is then done through what we call the performance management, Mr. Okam. So if a person or somebody is unable to perform, so those are the two instruments which are being considered, and you correct that through that. So there is no way cadre deployment comes in the Public Service Act or regulations. You never come across that word in the document or the website of the government. It shouldn't be mixed. I just wanted to correct that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Kaiso. Let me thank. I see Honorable Mare's hand is up. Am I correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay, please come in.
Now, I just want to ask, please help me and assist me. There was conveyed to us that there is a slight increase. It was like 0.002 or something to the 9 provinces. And something I don't understand, and there was in the sense of that Mr. Kieswetter, that is the head of SARS, at some stage there was an article in the newspaper that they increased the income dramatically. So I'm just asking, if that's the case, there should be an increase of the income and eventually maybe a little bit more to the 9 provinces. You can just have some light on that one. Thank you, sir.
Honorable Okamp, I called you, but I see your hand is up. Quickly, one question.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. It's not a question. It's just a bit of a reply to Honorable Paisa's statement. Honorable Chairperson.
Chairperson Mlengana here.
What?
Can
what
I be protected, Chairperson?
I wanted to raise the point of order, if you want to.
No. Let me allow Honorable Okamp to continue. Honorable Okamp.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Honourable Chairperson, the reason why I brought in cater deployment is that the most amount of people that are not meeting their KPIs, the key performance indicators, are unfortunately people that are cater deployed and that does not know what they must do in the positions that they are there for. It's time that we employ competent people to do their jobs. So, but let's leave that debate for another day between us as committee members. I would just like to hear what the FFC and PBSO's response is to the whole issue surrounding cater deployment and surrounding the fact that we need proper people that manages our internal government, internal departments that we've got in government. Thank you, Chairperson.
Honorable Zana, want to come in?
Yes, thanks, Chair. Excuse me for not opening my video. I'm driving also like Honorable Nkwango. Chair, I'm happy if then this issue would be discussed thoroughly because, look, I wanted a situation where we have to avoid dragging FFC into party political issues because now it's now beginning to be at that stage. But then I'm happy if then there will be a time and, space for us to clarify these terminologies that begin to confuse us. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honorable Nenzanum. In fact, that's the FFC and TVO, this cater deployment thing, it's more of a political debate. We are going to be debating both the amendment to the Division of Revenue and the amendment to the appropriations. So I think the other members are itching to go. Please just hold your horses, then you'll start debating the issue there. If I may throw in my questions, the first one, I think it goes to both of you. The debt service costs have increased compared to the budget. Does this suggest lack of coordination between monetary and fiscal policy? That's number one. Number two, it's related to what Raul Matafa raised. I've listened to TDO and FFC from in many instances, but you never touch on the trade policy of our country, which has got a direct impact on the budget of the country. Do you think that the trade policies are consistent with both the monetary and the fiscal policies, and are they consistent with what we are trying to do in the country to deal with the trilemma of unemployment, poverty, and inequality? Next question. I don't know whether you've done a start on this one. What do you think? I want your comment. What do you think ESCOM has cost the economy by its load shedding? I'm sure there are figures, both in terms of GDP lost and in terms of revenue. The next question, there is a special appropriation bill and it includes Transnet. I'm sure you'll agree with me. It's the first time the Transnet comes to Parliament to request for a recapitalization. What is it that's happening there? Do we know exactly what is the problem so that we don't deal with the effect, we deal with the cost? I would like to hear a comment. And perhaps a related question would be, do you think that we have been able to get the maximum benefit from the high commodity prices internationally? Next question, the allocation of funds through local government equity share through COOPTA, do you think that's the most optimal way of doing it? Do you want to comment? Any one of you can comment on that one. TDO, you are saying the increase of the repo rate has less to do with inflation and more to do with trying to attract or stem the outflow of capital. And obviously you are talking about hot money here, but the impact of it on fixed investment it's negative. Am I correct? So on a cost benefit analysis, what do you think is the right a monetary response to what is happening? I'm sure you saw yesterday that Tonga Tulet in KZN has gone to business rescue, and obviously the impact on unemployment and on the small farmers and big farmers is going to be very huge. So again, that just says that foreclosures and companies closing down is not about only SOEs. We're having this big company which has been there for decades. But the question is, looking at the impact of the forest real estate ends up being winding up, what do you think the right government response should be? And lastly, do you think it's the right macroeconomic strategy to rush for primary balance with all these challenges that we're having? I will start with FFC, take your questions and answer and try to be direct to the questions. And then after that, I'll allow PPO to come in. Doctor, and we're giving you about 15, let me see. Yeah, we'll give you 15 minutes to respond to the questions with your team.
Thank you so much to the chairperson and to the members for the questions. Chairperson, I'll attempt to answer the question from Honorable Peters. The question regarding the FRD, I think it's a very pertinent question that she asked. Indeed, we do believe that the Social Development Department declared unspent funds of 1.8 billion due to lower than anticipated take up of the social grant, because they claim that there were fewer applicants or they had stringent criteria. I think the important aspect to note is that we need to make sure that government is actually reaching the people who need to get the grant. So if we're sending back 1.8 billion, we must be comfortable that indeed there are people out there who do not need this money. If there are, then it's unfortunate that many people have been left out who actually deserve these funds. So I think a recommendation maybe to the Social Development Department is to just review their criteria to make sure that it does not exercise gatekeeping in terms of keeping out those who really need the money. And we must appreciate, honorable members, that over 7.4 million people benefit from the FRD. And the SRD grant has actually really supported households in terms of boosting their consumption and saving many people from being destitute. So it is a very important grant for many of our people who rely on it in terms of consumption. So we need to make sure that we protect our most vulnerable. We do believe that government at this time is still grappling with the question of whether to make the FRD permanent in whatever shape or form. We appreciate that the issue is complex and demands a lot of thinking from government side. We know that for the next 3 years, government foresees a primary budget surplus, but that is contingent on maintaining a fiscal path that is stable. So a possible basic income grant will obviously erode that primary balance surplus, and we need to make sure that we are aware of the impact of that. So whilst we support government to maintain its fiscal consolidation without leaving the poor and the more vulnerable, we do believe that the poor should also be protected while we maintain our fiscal consolidatory path. So we understand that the issues are complex and that governments must think through these things, but we believe that we need to have a policy certainty as well, so that the vulnerable and the poor of our people can be certain that going forward they will have some sort of income. Because the reality is that many of our people will never actually get a job, will never have some sort of income to assist their livelihood. So an SRD grant or any amount will actually go a long way to put food on the table. So that is my view. I do believe that the researchers as well, they have done some analysis, and I'd like to hand over to the head of research to answer some of the questions as well.
Thank you, Chair, and thanks again to the Honourable Chair and members for the questions. If I may deal with them in reverse, and that's what is most, I guess, freshest in the mind. Debt service costs with respect to monetary and fiscal policy coordination, I think there's not so much to coordinate when one, particularly one that is of small open economy in the global economy, such as South Africa. However, one does, from between the two policies, and Chair, you are correct, in that if one is able to really project and install confidence and credibility on the one hand, it means that on the other one, the one would have, shall we say, an easier time to manage. For example, if fiscal credibility is so strong, everything is funded, sustainability is very convincing, then there isn't much of a pressure on the monetary side to have to sort of hike interest rate, hike the returns to attract investments to ensure that your fiscal envelope is funded, for instance. So it's these kind of trade-offs and a balancing between the two that I would say is the most importance in this articulating between the two policy instruments, and admittedly the pretty much the only two policy instruments that public sector can manipulate. Question mark, trade policy, indeed. South Africa, I think it has not yet. You recall that FFC in the past, especially for a few years, reasons that we constantly pushing for this localized product value chain and growth and into inclusive growth. And it talks about essentially what is our niche product. That's, and the processes all behind it to push this product forward to the market and outward to the world market, global market. And the trade policy, I think, it's quite silent or invisible in considering these economic recovery and economic policies in general. On the cost of ESCOM, indeed, it's at the Portfolio Committee on Enterprises, Chair Commission, the Commission did make a measure on the days lost due to this days of economic activities lost because of these load sheddings. And I think one simply has to divide by those times and areas and to get a sense. But essentially, it's quite debilitating in that is what we've presented there in terms of days lost is obviously the direct cost. The indirect cost is all the damages to the infrastructure when once, you know, just flips the switch at the main switch, and then it can trip out a lot of, you know, sort of small, delicate equipment and instruments throughout the whole country. So that is, I would say, the debilitating and indirect cost of the ESCOM and load shedding in general. That is obviously much more difficult to measure. Macro policy balance, primary as a focus, we shall say it's a bit, it's more lenient, the measure, because it has not yet considered all the government guarantees, all the other sort of after the financial year costs or through during the financial year costs with respect to debts. But I think it is at least in the from the point or perspective of accounting and operating costs perspective or current cost perspective, it is at least a measure to push us to the right direction. But of course, that's why it's never good enough to just look at one measure, but one has to look at also other measures. I shall leave the Transnet cost and other SOC issues to later my other sort of answers. We have not, I think South Africa has not maximizes benefit of these commodity cycles because of all these infrastructure and instruments breakdowns and expired equipment. And also, I think if from the perspective that our production function to do with commodities, production, right, mining and so forth, are not Pareto efficient from the fact that of from their operating deficiencies and also their profitabilities in relation to the commodity cycles. I think there's a lot more room, especially from the long-term perspective, that can be improved. Allocation of the LGES through COPTA. It's not as easy, Chair, because to answer, not because that it's just from the actual expenditures and evidence and data that emanated from these transfers, is that it seems that whether direct, indirect, or through provinces, right? Provinces also give these direct or indirect grants to local governments. And all of, if a municipality is not capacitated or without the capability to spend and properly manage their municipal finances, it's ultimately resources that goes into waste and redundancies. Moving forward, I think, on the overall fiscal framework and the divisional revenue, Honourable Chair and members, the measures that we calculated in terms of provinces and allocations and the trend, they are in real terms. So what that means is obviously that if you see a negative number there, it's inflation adjusted. Right. In nominal terms, there are still increases, but I would say that's actually not exactly the main point, saying that because national SARS collected more revenue, so everyone must also have more revenue. I think really, as it is the case with within these spheres, national, provincial, local, is really the reprioritization within to make sure that it is that you don't waste money on a function that is dysfunctional. So coming to the overall economic growth, Chair, we at the next briefing, which will focus more on the DOR and as well the appropriation, I think FEC, we have something to present with regards to this. How does one what does one mean about economic growth? And we, FFC has undertaken to also incorporate the issues like geography, where people are residing, and also the shall we say, the natural environments associated with the local environments in a local zone to understand that how this economic growth should come about, the local contextualization, shall we say, of the economic growth. I think this is incredibly important because where we the so far, right, at these briefings, one only has been looking at numbers, talked about functional classifications or economic classifications, but the ultimate, shall we say, engines of growth are none other than two things, right? One is human or labor, and the other one capital, but they are not equal or evenly distributed across the landmass of South Africa. They are concentrated in particular pockets, and also the way that they are concentrated is they are correlated. There is a meaning behind this. For instance, water infrastructure or certain industrial areas, they don't just sit somewhere out in a remote area where there are no people. They are situated close nearby, whether if it's water infrastructure, it has to be near water streams, it has to be near rivers, or if it's industrial zones, you need people, and also definitely logistics. So this, we are incorporating essentially at the Commission, this sort of city planning and or city development planning / economic growth planning approach to really take on this this localization and local contextualization of economic growth to ensure that where there are people are included in this process. So there we will share some of the portrayal or illustration of this approach that I've just spoken about. So something to look forward to. On the ESCOM SOC, my last point before I hand over to my colleagues. I think ultimately, with regards to these operational deficiencies and financial and emanating as financial maladministration or malfeasance in the financial management, ultimately we get this sort of drawdown on the debt. There are two aspects to it. One is on the operational side, there are three components I think that SOCs really and as government as a whole must look towards. One is procurement management. So basically when government buys stuff or then spend money. The other one is contract management. There are just so many of these contracts that are sitting on the balance sheets, continuously hemorrhaging money that needs to be dealt with, whether it be cancelled or if it had to be fought out in the courts and others. But ultimately, those contracts, old contracts, some of them are evergreen and they are inefficient, ineffective, and wasting money. That is the reason why this operational deficiency is continuing. If we don't deal with those contracts, this will continue. The current operational deficiencies. And lastly is the payments management. I think the trouble with general sort of public sector administration and roles and responsibilities of accounting officers is that they don't see payments as an important vehicle to manage your finances, and which is baffles me, because payments is when you see money flow in or out of your resource or out of your fund as you are managing the fund. So it's incredibly important that these three are managed, and yet generally when we look at the balance sheets and these financial statements, we see that there's a lack of control in those three areas. And so what does the conditions mean? What do we mean by those stringent conditions on the SOCs and the funding thereof? It's precisely we're recommending then that these three areas could possibly become part of the criteria for these conditional transfers and or conditions for these special appropriations. So So the changes therein could motivate for the need for those or the use of those additional funds. And lastly, with regards to the covering of these taking on of the ESCOM debt, there are two aspects to it. One is that these debts are, yes, it will become a bigger debt burden, obviously, on the fiscus. But the other thing is that because of being debt and the GEPF has been an example of this, is that the ESCOM debts are also high risk and therefore high reward. And so what essentially we coming out with when, say, government takes on using, say, another public funds to fund a public entity, and essentially you're making the overall financial portfolio of this entity and the fund bigger because you're connecting the two together as one bigger entity or financially connected entity. And so this may ultimately result in, shall we say, the so-called too big to fail phenomenon of the public sector. We saw that as an example in the financial sector in the US during the financial crisis. But I think in this context, one really has to be careful, not just, of course, on the fact that taking on these debts will increase the debt burden on the fiscus, but also the long-term implication of it is that the incentive vested interest therein may not be quite optimal going forward. Thank you, Chair.
So you are indirecting FFC, but thank you. Should you then go to PBO?
Thank you so much, Chairperson and members, for the input.
Sorry, Doc. Can I request everybody to mute his or her mic, please? Continue, Doc.
Thank you so much, Chairperson. I think there's quite a lot of questions, and we really appreciate the questions from members. I think given time, I really touch on broadly policy issues, and I give the colleagues to really give some quick response in specific matters. I think, Chair and members, the main message that we're coming with here, we say, looking at the current macroeconomic policy outcomes we've had over the years, the fact that, you know, not much, there hasn't been much growth, much realization of socioeconomic aspirations. We're saying certainly a need for macroeconomic policy reform, particular looking at that supported by social policy, but also issues around the trade and industrial policy in particular. I mean, the time when we had a lot of growth, Chair members, and we created more employment in our economy was when the public corporations and government's investment was way above the rates that we have now. And also the NDP had actually taken that into account. And I think that would go a long way. Use the fiscal policy support both investment in economy and particularly with the role of public corporations as well. The issue around the monetary policy, I'll come quickly, comment quickly on social policy and the industrial policy. The issue around monetary policy is a very important one, in particular, Chair, because when you look at the data from 1995 until 2020 on the real long-term interest rate in South Africa, compared to OECD countries, we've certainly had a higher in long-term interest rate, in particular, compared to many, more than 90% of the OECD countries. And we have not, at the same time, really advanced our socioeconomic development like they have. And we have not also realized a lot of economic development that many of them have. But I think why I'm mentioning that is that when you look at the relationship between the credit extension to private sector, there's a close relationship between the credit extension to the private sector and the real investment in the economy. And clearly, that shows that as the interest rate grows, or the movement of interest rate does affect the real investment in the economy from private sector. The case in point example that when we look at the year between 2004 and 1996 and 2008, we've seen actually that there was a lot of credit extension to private sector, and during the same time there's a quite real investment from the private sector as a result of the access to credit in this regard. And such collapse post financial crisis where we've seen there was a limited extension credit to private sector, and hence they have not been able to really invest in the economy. So certainly that scenario, that story tells us that there's certainly a need for reform within the monetary policy, how it impacts or how they work together with fiscal policy to enhance development in that regard. And issues around the social policy building up a lot towards really supporting households, but also ensuring stability and also ensuring resilience. So it's very important to also look at it within that macroeconomic reform. The issue of side policy is a very important issue because a three component total investment in manufacturing sector is very important because that has a very and we've seen quite a low in that regard. And one point before I give to my team to comment also is around the increased localization and the issue of the use of public procurement is a very important issue. We've raised a point earlier in the year to say public procurement has to be seen within the policy, economic development policy of South Africa. I've seen over the recent weeks, over the recent months, yes, there's a lot of debate in public about how much the preferential procurement structure policies are not working. And in my view, such debate lack context or lack substance to understand how much the issue of addressing the structured economy, but also a diversifying economy, inclusive economy, will go a long way providing much needed stability in our economy and development. So it's very important to understand the role of public procurement within the context of supporting industrial policy, but also localization within dealing with the ensuring economies can grow locally, and there's a mass support from locally in that regard. I'll stop there, just broadly give Dr. Olandi and Dr. Mohammed to come in as well. Thank you, Chair and members. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Director. I will just answer two questions. The one was from Honorable Matafa in terms of the reduction in the division of revenue. Unfortunately, we didn't get time to present that slide, but if you can look at slide 42, we actually indicate that it's not really, it seems like a reduction in the division of revenue or the equitable share to provinces. You must realize in 2022-23, there was additional funds allocated to provinces. So it seems like a reduction, but if you do the calculation from the from 2021, it actually increases. And also in the new budget, the equitable share to provinces over the medium term, it increases by 2.4%, whereas in the budget, the increase was only 1%. And the allocation in 2023-24 is actually also now higher than what it was in the 2022 budget. The equitable shares was 543 billion, and it's now increased to 556 billion for 2023. So it actually increased from the previous budget. But also then to note that additional funds were allocated in 2022. So it might look like a reduction, but that allocation was just in terms of COVID funds to respond to COVID-19. In terms of Honorable Moletsane, you asked about the disaster and the MTPBS is quiet. The MTPBS might be quiet, but a lot of allocations or there has been provided for in the adjustments budget for disasters to address several all the disasters that has happened during the year. And I'm sure it will also include allocations for Jagersfontein. Specifically, the increase to corporate governance, specifically for unforeseen and unavoidable was 3.6 or is 3.6 billion. So a lot of adjustments has been made in the adjustments budget for unforeseen and unavoidable allocations. I think there was a few other, and Misani also spoke about the localization, and Honorable Peters spoke about the effects of the floods and CO2 emissions. Honorable members, during our analysis of the medium-term strategic framework, we actually realized that all of these matters that we've been talking about has been addressed in the medium-term strategic framework. It is there, it is indicated as priorities, but unfortunately those priorities doesn't translate into outputs in APPs. So that's why it is so important for us to make sure in terms of our monitoring role, that we make sure that those priorities and outcomes or outputs that are included in the medium-term strategic framework actually translate into outputs in the APPs, because then we are sure that they are within budget programs that are funded, it's in structures that are managed, and departments are also then forced to report on the quarterly and annual basis on those priorities in the medium-term strategic framework. Thank you, Honourable Members.
Thank you, Chair. I know we're fast running out of time, so I'm going to restrict myself to answering two questions, the one on interest rates and the one on structural reforms versus structural transformation, with your permission. Just to say that, you know, there's a real need to understand how South Africa is integrated into global financial markets and what that means, particularly as we said in our presentation, that we attract short-term interest rates and that a lot of the outflows that we're seeing on our current account are not related to the trade deficit and the fact that, you know, we've had many years where exports were more than imports and we've had a positive trade balance, but we've had a negative current account balance. And that has been because of financial outflows. So on the balance of payments, you have a financial account and you have a current account, and people, including I think people at our National Treasury, assume that anything that happens in the current account is trade related. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't have the right kinds of trade policies and support and also increase localization and those things. And I agree with what both Nelia and my director said on these issues. I think what we need to understand is that a lot of the future prospects for growth, whether there's, you know, what happens in global financial markets now with higher interest rates, for instance, is going to mean that South Africa has to increase interest rates. If there is a financial crisis because of increased interest rates and lots of corporate debt and also sovereign debt in other countries, it will have impacts on South Africa. So I think what we saw following the global financial crisis, particularly during COVID, and I think now with the UNCTAD's warning, that things could be worse than the global financial crisis and the shock from the COVID-19 epidemic on economies, we need to start looking at domestically what we can do and how do we build resilience. And the fact that when you have this kind of situation that the private sector and households are going to limit the expenditure into the economy, the only space for growth and the only way to build resilience and the only way to protect yourself from what's happening is through an actually stimulative government policy. Plus, there needs to be, just to answer your question on coordination between fiscal and monetary policy, we need to actually have more coordination and for the Reserve Bank to realize that even though they're independent, they can't allow the South African economy to suffer through this high interest rate regime. So that may mean looking at how you manage debt and how you manage interest rates in a different way and a better way to build the stimulative impact of government spending on the economy and to keep sovereign debt low. And that's something we've actually said quite a bit during the COVID-19 crisis, and now it seems like that examining those issues is going to be more important. And so in response to Mr. Ryder's, Honorable Ryder's point, is that South Africa has, compared to other countries, our real interest rates are high. Other countries have increased their interest rates, but it's only in the last few months that the European Union, for instance, has a positive real interest rate. The US
got to that point earlier this year. South Africa, through COVID and through the post-global financial crisis, has had positive real interest rates for much of that period. So we need to actually think about how we interact on what's going to happen in the world and how that impacts on us through global financial markets particularly, but also through trade and also the possibility for shock and the need to build resilience. And we're in moving on then to the issue of structural transformation versus structural reforms, the structural transformation doesn't allow us to then react to that. It reinforces the current businesses by reducing red tape and trying to increase the environment for those businesses. To some extent, it talks about competition and increasing competition, but they don't say how, and they expect it to happen automatically. There needs to be a real shift in how we think about transformation in terms of the sectors in the economy, what's being produced. And so there needs to be that shift up the value chains. We need to actually build global our involvement in global value chains, but also regional in Southern Africa and Africa with the free trade agreement, and that links again to the trade policy discussions. Now, linked to that, this issue of what's the relationship between social grants, social welfare, and social security and structural transformation is that the money that gets supported and spent into poor households can actually be part of a sustained process of having inclusive growth and shifting South Africa out of this low growth rut into a new transformation growth path that is based on what people need, housing, school, education, healthcare, and those things to drive that. And a lot of that can be produced locally and can be part of a local strategy that's supported by industrial policy, supported by trade, and we can also work with the regional value chains and also export more and be part of helping to build those capacities within region and Africa as well. So I know I've taken a lot of time in there. The last question on the ISCOM debt swap by Serapin, we haven't done the modeling, but based on the numbers we're seeing from National Treasury, we're expecting about 1.8% of GDP to be added to government debt. And that's happening in a time when inflation has caused nominal GDP to increase. So the debt to GDP rate has actually come down because of inflation. So inflation, to some extent, and I've read this recently, that for certain countries in the world, including us, the inflation has actually had a bit of good news on the one side, because it's actually brought down and contribute to that debt to GDP coming down. And so I think we must be less worried now that that's going to cause problems in accessing global debt markets and those things. There are much bigger problems in terms of many countries facing much more serious sovereign debt problems, but also large corporations, private sector corporations around the world having huge amounts of debt. So the problems in debt markets, South Africa looks small compared to what's happening in global debt markets. And so I think we relatively speaking, we're actually in a fairly good position there, and we should be less worried than others. I'm not saying we shouldn't be worried, but we should be thinking about that. So I'm going to stop there, Honorable Chair. I'm sorry if I took up too much time. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Just a last point, Chairperson. Just to add, I think the issue around, I can't put on my video because my other device is dead now. And I think the issue around extension of the social relief grant or household support, we have proposed, we've shown in our before that there are areas where additional source of revenue could be sourced, in particular support such initiative. And I think in our analysis, in our view as well, we emphasize the importance of really some of those measures could be temporary, but some of the measures of additional revenue could be actually more permanent. And I think we provide such analysis in the current proposals, but also in our previous analysis. We'll provide more responses, Chair, next week during the DORA and adjusted budget presentation. Thank you so much for the opportunity, and sorry for taking too much time. Thanks.
Thanks, Doc. Doc and Dr. Siraj, while you are still there, and I'll be saying same thing to Mr. Chen and Dr. Mbava. I deliberately threw in the question of Thomas Chilet, and I said, what should be the government's response? On your feet, please.
think on your feet. Siraj?
Yeah, sorry. I actually haven't studied the situation with Tonga Dulet. But my immediate reaction when I saw the news yesterday was that government is going to have to step in to try to reduce the impact, even if the company gets saved on the loss of jobs and on that community, because we saw in July 2021 the impact of stability, and which I think is very much related to unemployment and poverty. So on the one hand, I think a lot of, for me, government's response should be on support and bolstering the community in this really hard time. And then in terms of saving the company, I think there needs to be a thorough look at the financials and the business rescue process and what Tonga Dulet will add to the economy and how it fits into regional and global value chains as well. Because a lot of the sugar industry, as far as I know, the little I know about it, is that it is quite a scale economy. It's a capital intensive economy. You do have the farming and the cutting of sugarcane that lots of farmers are affected by, but the actual price structure is shaped by how big your production is. And if other countries have larger production facilities, they have better economies of scale, and then you become much less productive and you can't even compete against imports. So I don't have answers, but I think there are lots of questions. Thank you for the opportunity. Honorable Chair.
Can I come in there?
Yes,
Chair, thank you so much. Think of the feed. I think lessons can be learned from what happened in the post-2008 crisis. But I think, in a way, you know, adding on what Dr. Mam is saying, any such support should also take into account the equity provision, say, if support, because, I mean, you'd expect that the issue, the sector, I mean, I think the first point is say it shouldn't be only the company in particular, but more a sector-wide issue to say which are the sectors that require government support and how that's aligned with the broad issues around creating more jobs in particular. But if such support is provided, it has to have an equity portion to it, whereby there's some punitive measures for discouraging future derailing or so, you know, within the sectors. But more so, there has to be some support as well. I agree with Dr. Mawai. Thank you, Chen.
Thank you. Chen?
Chair? Yes, Robert Chair. This is indeed quite a challenge. Ultimately, I think it's always people first, money second, and companies. It's my understanding that they will always try to first take the money and run. But I think putting the people first would be my initial answer to it, but understanding, I think, the broader industry type questions, I think I agree with my colleagues from PBO that one does have to look into, again, understanding what South Africa is good at, what we need to improve on. Chair.
Thank you. Dr. Mbava, last week.
I think Dr. Olani was on as well, Chair. Dr. Olani.
Okay. Sorry, I don't want to respond to the ULIT issue. I just wanted to say quickly, in terms of the additional funds to SANRO, Honourable Chair, previously, in previous years, basically each and every year, in terms of the adjustments budget, there was a transfer from non-toll roads to the toll road. So that is how they actually funded the debt in terms of the toll road in previous years. And you also had a question in terms of the equitable share to local government, whether it should be in corporate governance in that department. I think we should discuss that further, because that is basically the entire budget of corporate governance is the equitable share transfer to local government. And the minister also at one stage indicated that they don't really do oversight or the monitoring of the expenditure of the equitable share in local government. That function is actually provided by the National Treasury. So I think there is a bigger debate that we can have in terms of where the equitable share to local government must be. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Nini. Dr. Mbava?
I'm covered, Chair. I have no further comments. I think my research has covered everything. Thanks.
Honorable Taisa, were you saying something?
Yes, Chair. I'm sorry. I missed the point on the issue of land bank and the conditions on ESCOM, you know, that are strict or more strict. What was the advice of the FSC on those matters? I didn't get the response there, but it's fine. If we don't have time, perhaps we responded.
Let's allow FSC and PPO to quickly attend to that. Can you have a response? Colleagues from PBO and FFC about the land bank issue and the conditions. Do you want to comment on that?
Yes, thank you, Honorable Chair and Honorable Member. I think looked at the land bank's balance sheets in the past few years and in all the special appropriations that have been sort of dealt to the bank, I think it ultimately again comes down to those raising issues about that financial flow that I mentioned about between, for example, other entities and obviously land bank being one of such example. I think it's when it comes to these financial instruments and associated with particular economic input and growth inputs, the most important one probably being the land, and I think the returns on them, the conditions and those the way that these financial assistance are provided, that is where the problem would lie. I think further than that, I think we would the Commission would then compile a more thorough and detailed report on the matter and submit it to the committee, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think the issue of the SOE it really links broadly to the economic development issue, because what we have said in the previous report on state-owned entities and finance was really an issue of trying to have a clear comparison between the commercial mandate and the developmental mandate, because as I said earlier on, Chair and members, is that the SOEs have played a very important role in investing the economy over the years, where we've seen a lot of investment and so many support to economic development and employment being created. And therefore, one of the conditions then on our members and colleagues would around the support portion of it or part of it being directly related to investment and the entities show that they actually invest in the economy as it's required, or in a way supporting the entities to get more credit to be able to invest. Because the purpose of the SOEs, in the literature at least, it's really to deal with market failures in particular, and that's when you realize your developmental economic activities there. And I think in my view the conditions should be centered around that in particular, say what's the purpose of this entity and how do we make sure that support that's given out is really linked to the value creation by the entities in particular. I mean, it's a very widely broad point, but I think it will go a long way. And I think the oversight mechanisms as well has to really be in those three layers as well, in the government, in the entities themselves, but also within parliament, on ensuring those mandate or those value expected is created within the entities. Thank you, Chair. Just think of my feedback. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Honorable Members, thanking the honorable chairs from the four committees, and then thank the PBO and the FSC. As I close this agenda item, I deliberately raised the question of Tongatulet, because it's a very important economic player in that part of the country, but I think in the country in general, direct and indirectly, both at the manufacturing level and at the primary level as far as agriculture is concerned. So I also agree that government can't fold its arms. I think the negative impact will be too dire, especially as far as employment creation is concerned. But honorable members, I think this then proves the correctness of the position of government when you say every challenge, every company should be looked on its merit and demerit, whether government should have a role or not. It also perforates the argument which says that everything run by private sector, it's perfect. Here's Thomas Hulett going down on its knees, and government, as far as we are concerned, should intervene. And the suggestion of government taking equity to try and protect jobs and the economy in that part of the country, I think for me, is very important. Obviously, take into consideration all the financial indicators and agreeing how we get in there, because the closure of that company in KZN will have dire consequences. So private hands are not a panacea. Let's deal with each and every firm on its merits. Just like it was demonstrated during the global economic crisis, where you had private companies running to government to say, please nationalize us, please take equity, and so on and so forth. So we need to be very pragmatic as we deal with these things. But thank you very much, everybody who has contributed on this session, and looking forward to meeting with PBO and FFC in the future. And thank the honorable members from NCOP for participating in this discussion. Thank you very much. That takes care of this agenda item. You may remain on the platform. We are a transparent organization. Honorable Masongai, would you like to say something? Chair? Honorable Chair?
Thanks very much, Shanga. I hope you have conveyed my apology that I was attending another very crucial meeting. We work as a collective. Thanks for steering the ship to make sure that the meeting proceeds as scheduled. The next meeting is what? Is it PBO? Is it after 12 or is it 1 o'clock?
Yeah, there is the management and directors meeting PBO.
Are we not supposed to attend?
Dumsan, yes, you are. At half past 12. Let's talk about it offline.
Okay. Yes. Thanks, sir.
Okay. Thank you so much. Let's go to the next agenda item. Let me check with Lubabala. Are there any announcements you would like to make?
No, Chairperson, we don't have any announcements. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Alan?
Yes, Chair, the Standing Committee on Finance is meeting after the House sitting this evening to consider the General Laws Amendment Bill. So I'll be sending out the link and supporting documents immediately after this.
Thank you, Alan. Garin?
Chairperson, yes. Thank you. The Standing Committee on Appropriations will meet with National Treasury tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. National Treasury will brief the committee on the Division of Revenue Amendment Bill, Special Appropriation Bill, and Adjustments Appropriation Bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, colleagues. Again, let me thank you. Thank everybody on the platform support staff. I think this brings us to the end of this meeting. Thank you.